Beautiful gavel.
Use your nose.
Okay. Don't need one. We're good. We're good. Yep. Are we started?
Yeah, turn around. Shout.
Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the August 1, 2016 regular commission meeting of Chelan Public Utility District. This morning's session is a study session, and this afternoon is a business session. And I'd like to welcome everybody here. It's good to see we have a full house. Just a reminder before we get started today that as this meeting is recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, that you come up to the microphone that's provided here at the front to speak into that microphone. And for the record, give us your name and your address. Also like to remind people that we would appreciate it if you would silence your cell phones one way or the other. Today, all five commissioners are here, all the regular staff with the exception of manager Steve Wright. Sitting in for Steve is Greg Carrington for today's meeting. And with that, I'd like to move to item one of our agenda, the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute, brought to us by Emily Bofto.
I
pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Emily Bofto. I am a student in the communications department this summer. I will be a senior at Washington State University in the fall. So I have 2 weeks left here, so I brought the safety minute to you today, and it's about back-to-school safety. And it might seem like it's too early to talk about back-to-school safety, but it is August 1st, and every school district in Chelan County, except for Manson, goes back before the end of August. So it isn't too early. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is school zones. And school zones, as we all know, are 20 miles an hour, and if you do speed through a school zone or do something that is illegal, the fine is double. So just make sure you're watching, even if you're late to work, slow down, just be watching. The second thing that I'll talk about is school buses. School buses will be out and about, obviously, as school starts. So school buses have flashing red lights and flashing yellow lights. So if you see either of those, just slow down and watch out and be aware that kids will be out and they are unpredictable. They're probably the most unpredictable pedestrians that there are. So just be watching for them. Be watching for them getting off the school bus or getting on the school bus. Be aware. And the final thing that I'll talk about with back to school safety is safety patrol. Safety patrol can be kids or adults, and they'll tell you when to stop, where to stop, when to go, when it's your turn, where to turn. The whole kind of thing. So just be watching them, pay attention to them, and listen to them. So just be alert, be aware, be watching for kids. And that's pretty much, does anybody have any questions?
Just a brief comment. Your name strikes a very familiar bell in my ears, and I think probably with a lot of people in the room. Any relation to any of the famous school namesakes here in the Wenatchee Valley?
Yeah, the coach Lee Bofta was my grandfather.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There you go. I worked with
your grandfather for over 10 years.
Oh.
Tremendous respect for him.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm sure he appreciates that.
And I hope you're enjoying your internship.
Yes, it's been awesome. I've loved it. Yeah.
Nice job, Emily.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Commissioners, we have before us a proposed agenda, and I'd like to note that we're going to make a few changes to that with your permission. Especially this afternoon, the executive session will be canceled for this week. Additionally, time permitting this morning, we will move some manager items, potentially commission items, and potentially follow up on delegation action items to the morning. We don't know what the morning looks like, but this afternoon will probably be much abbreviated as a result of that. Any other suggestions or from the commissioners on agenda items? And also anybody in the audience, if there's an item they wish to place on the agenda, that request could be made now, and the commissioners would consider that request. If I hear no input, the agenda will be approved as amended. Item 3, awards and announcements.
So I'm going to ask Jeff Smith and John Stoll to come up.
John Stoll is shortly.
Okay.
Good morning, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services.
Government Affairs Program Manager.
And it is great pleasure that we recognize Suzanne as one of this year's winners of the Women with Hydrovision Award, which was presented during last week's Hydrovision International Conference in Minneapolis. And you want to show them the hardware?
Sure. He wants me to pass it around.
You bet.
She's a little modest.
She's very humble.
This award program is designed to honor the most influential women in the hydropower industry.
Wow.
And we all know that Suzanne is very deserving. Her intellect, her knowledge, political connections, reputation, boundless energy are of huge benefit to the district. She's also very much a respected industry authority in hydro matters. And her direct boss, Tracy, would like a few words as well.
Good morning, Tracy. I'm Director of External Affairs. And when I think of Suzanne, there are some words that come to mind, and maybe some of them are the same for you. Dedicated, thoughtful, energetic, tenacious, caring, genuine, persuasive. And I have one word. I think I've actually heard a couple people say it before, but it's radar. Suzanne has an uncanny ability to digest copious amounts of information and make it into something and make us understand what it means way before the rest of us typically see it. So it's a great Suzanne is a great asset to the district. We're really lucky to have her as part of the team. And I just want to thank you and congratulate you, on a job well done. Thank you very
much. I just wanted to say really briefly that Hydrovision made this so nice, and they try to recognize women in the industry. And as I've come to this industry, I have found it extremely welcoming, very encouraging, had so many mentors, men and women, throughout my career. And it was just a nice opportunity right now for me to thank PUD for allowing me to take the time to participate in some of these industry associations on behalf of the PUD, but also on behalf of hydropower. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Suzanne.
And before you go away, Suzanne also accepted an award on Greg's behalf last week while she was in Minneapolis. It's an appreciation and recognition of service award from the Hydro Research Foundation for his work as president of that group 2014 through 2016. Maybe explain what the foundation is.
Basically, the Hydro Research Foundation is a nonprofit organization geared towards education related to the hydropower industry. So you may have heard about the scholarships that they handed out to master level, PhD level students throughout the U.S., including Washington State and UW and so forth. And through Department of Energy, they were given monies to hand out in the form of endowments and scholarships that they used. And the purpose was to get people to concentrate and think about hydropower as a renewable energy, get it back into the curriculums at colleges and universities. Believe it or not, there's only one university in the country that actually has a hydropower curriculum, and that's Oregon Tech in Portland area. And everybody else teaches hydrology and hydraulics, but nothing specific to hydropower. So we're trying to get people to recognize hydropower as a renewable energy.
Thank Congratulations,
you.
Greg.
And when I picked up the award for Greg,
I haven't seen it yet.
No, he hasn't seen it yet, so yeah. I'm going to bring it over there. But I also wanted to point out that he's helped them with their strategic planning process, which they were very appreciative of. And when I picked this up for you, I just mentioned to them that I see how busy Greg is. We all know that, you know, Greg's a high performer, but he really takes time to focus on this group with, you know, these young people and bringing them into the industry. And you can tell that the Research Foundation really appreciates his help and work. So
thanks.
Last comment, the staff of the foundation had a couple of comments too. Besides implementing a strategic plan, they credited Greg with developing a reserve operating fund and providing strategic leadership. And quote here, he is a tremendous asset to the foundation, and we have so much gratitude for his extraordinary work ethic. So congratulations.
Thanks.
After. We're not done yet.
Okay. But before Suzanne gets totally away, I would like to add one thing to what Tracy said. She does all those marvelous things that Tracy talks about and still takes time to be a great mom to three young kids. I see them in church every Sunday. So.
Yeah. We have one more before John comes up. Rich Hyatt, I think most of you have had a chance to meet him as our security director. He's been with us about a year. He's been elected chairman of the Physical Security Working Group for the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, or WEC, which you've heard us talk a lot about. Mm-hmm. It's an important group both to the district and the industry, and I thought I'd ask Rich to explain what the function of that group is.
Yeah, sure. Good morning, commissioners. The group is a very highly visible position, volunteer leadership, that promotes physical security measures and design among the utility sector. There's over 100 utilities in the Western region that participate on this working group. And the chairman of the group, me, I've been affiliated with the organization since 2012. And I've taken on the leadership just a couple of weeks ago. I facilitate communications, a pathway for all the security professionals in these utilities to kind of communicate on best practices, initiatives. A lot of NERC-SIP compliance, a lot of sharing of ideas, information. It's a great resource to have that ability to pick up the phone and call one of 100 or so security professionals in the industry to find out what their organization is doing and lessons learned before you go down the path of making a bad mistake. So that's what I do.
That's great.
Rich has instigated some remarkable improvements in the year that he's been with us. I guess the bottom line is he's instilled a disciplined approach to ensuring the security of the district's physical assets, its employees, and our customer owners. We're very fortunate to have him here. And if you detect the New York accent, yes, he is a diehard Yankee fan. We've heard him anyway.
And John?
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll. I'd like to invite up Tika Sellers. You may have seen recently the Wenatchee World 30 Under 35 that came out. It's our pleasure to nominate Tika to that, and she was accepted. Tika, in her role as Customer Service Relations Administrator, has just been a dynamo in all the work she does out there in the community and works with our customers day in and day out. I don't know what our business unit would do without her. So. It was really nice that she was recognized, but it also speaks to her other activities, her involvement with youth, her involvement with the skating community as well. So, again, it was a great opportunity to recognize these folks. I know several of us went to the award ceremony they had last Thursday night at the Wenatchee World. It was very impressive to see the group, and it was really neat that Tika was part of it. So, thank you, Tika. Thank you. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
I wasn't prepared. Do I have to say anything?
You've never been at a law.
I know, that's very true.
Wait. I think like to
I just wanted to mention too. The Wenatchee World.
Say your name. Introduce yourself.
Customer service. The Wenatchee World recognized Chelan County PUD's willingness to sponsor that.
For a rattlesnake, that was well spoken.
Okay.
We'd like to get a picture with the commissioners and the board.
Up in front of the flag.
Right by the flag.
How about just the president?
How about just the president?
Let's have the commissioners in back and the award winners in front. Okay, look close here, gentlemen. In the middle. There we go, Gary, Dennis, and there we go, Carnan. There we go, close. Yes, it's going to have to be closer than it feels comfortable.
Just the tank group.
And then the winner's front, ladies. please. Okay. All right.
I'm the short one, so you better.
Yes, I was just going to say that.
If the camera can see us.
All right. There we go.
Greg, perfect.
Say if you can see the camera, it can see you.
Can you see Gary?
Where's Dennis?
Tika, did he say involvement with skiers or skaters?
Skaters.
Oh, okay. Right. Ice skaters. Oh, really? Interesting.
Well, thank you to all the award winners. It's great to get that occasional moment of inspiration that lets us know that the right people have got the right energy in our utility and are really out there doing good things. That's great.
And may I just make a comment too? Do you want me to go? So, I just want to add on to that. Congratulations to all the award winners, and I'm particularly excited about the women who are receiving awards, because women have traditionally been underrepresented in the utility industry. At the commissioner level, they still are, but we're working on that. anyway, congratulations to all of you. Makes us very proud.
And then I'd just like to add that I have often said, and I know it's the sentiment of my colleagues, that the greatest privilege of being a commissioner is to have the opportunity to get to know our employees and be able to, over time, understand the talent and skill level and the leadership that they provide. And then have that confirmed by other outside organizations is really kind of a full package in terms of, you know, to all of you honored today, what we feel and confirmed by others. And so we are very fortunate as commissioners. We are very fortunate as ratepayers to have the leadership that we have in this organization. And no wonder it's as good as it is. So thank you very much.
All right. Item 4 is high density load implementation. Who do I turn to?
Andy Wendell and John Stoll.
You all hear that, Tom?
Yes.
A little bit.
Yes.
I'm sure where that's doing. I don't think it's
good. Good afternoon, commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. With me, I have Andrew Wendell, Director of Customer Service. We wanted to just provide a brief update on the high-density load rate implementation. Since the rate was approved, now another round of work begins as we gear up to get ready to put this in place. So we also wanted to touch just a little bit about the upcoming hearing on October 3rd, which is the next discussion around the moratorium that's in place. So staff has just an initial recommendation for the commission to consider. We also want to talk a bit about the planning efforts as we implement this rate and the timeline going forward. Again, there's no action required. This is just sharing of information as we move forward. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew.
Thanks, John. Good morning, commissioners. As John mentioned, we reached a major milestone a couple of weeks ago, and very much appreciates engagement with the board and our leadership. But we still have a little bit of work to do, and we've been actively working on the implementation planning side of these. So at this point in time, based on the information that we have, staff would recommend that the HDL moratorium be continued through December 31st of this year. A couple of things we are evaluating right now is, What would it look like to allow the HDL applicants to submit their applications for new HDL services and or establish a priority placeholder for those applicants, you know, sometime in the October time frame? But we would recommend not energizing any new applications or any new services for HDL until January 1, when it would coincide with the new rate schedule. the effective date for the rate schedule. So these are some things we're looking at right now, either to accept applications but not energize them, and or develop a placement, a queue, if you will, for new applicants. It gives staff an opportunity to evaluate the magnitude and the impact of what new applications would be, and gives us a little bit of time to kind of crawl before we walk with just accepting these applications again. So that's kind of what we're thinking. The third bullet, probably most importantly, is we recognize there's a big engagement opportunity both with internal and external stakeholders. There has been a lot of change to our policies. There is a new rate, so we want to get out there and inform our employees and our community stakeholders on what that looks like. Here's a slide that talks about some specifics. As I mentioned, we have an internal process review team that's looking at the application processes and the fees and charges associated with that, in particular the $190 per KW capital upfront charge and how we would apply that. Additionally, developing a wide spectrum of various communications, presentations, and some literature for various stakeholders. And we're going to start a pretty heavy campaign of employee engagement starting this week, August 4th, during the manager's forum. We'll also be attending a wide spectrum of staff meetings and other forums that we can give employees an opportunity to ask questions and provide feedback as we move forward. Another one that we wanted to mention is we've scheduled for the August 30th tri-commission meeting. We're going to be providing the port and the county and other municipals an update on HDL during that time frame. So we've got a little bit of time. We're developing a presentation for that. We think that'll be a great opportunity to share with them a little bit about what we're thinking from an application perspective. We would like to align a little closer with the municipals and the county and the port district so that they can have potential HDL customers come to us and we can have a more engaging discussion prior to establishing service. Additionally, we recognize the North Central Washington Realtors Association is a big stakeholder. A lot of these new HDL customers that we've seen have been coming into properties that have been leased through a realtor. And so we want to talk with them about what's changed, rates, and how the application process is going to work with them. In particular, we're looking for that opportunity to make sure that they come talk to us before they just lease out space to an HDL customer so we have an opportunity to evaluate the integrity of that electric service. So we'll be working closely with them. That's actually this week as well. So as soon as I leave the manager's forum, I'll be high-footing it over to the Realtors Association that morning. We also are looking for an opportunity to pull together some of our major contractors in the area, specifically the electrical contractors. They have communicated a lot to us through this process, and we've communicated a lot to them as well, particularly associated with the infrastructure and ensuring everybody's installing safe, reliable electric services, including the electricians. So we want to engage them, talk to them about what we're thinking through the application processes. In fact, many of the applications that we receive for a new HDL customer are actually coming through the electricians that the HDL customers may have hired. And then finally, we know there's an opportunity to engage the Department of Labor and Industries, the electrical division. We would like to find out what they're learning about HDL customers, and we'd like to share information about what we're learning. We do have a close nexus with them when new services are approved, so we want to make sure that we're in alignment with their policies. Some additional staff actions that we're working on. We know, yes?
Andy, before we leave that, has there been any thought given to conversation with Steve Hendricks and IBEW?
You know, there's a potential there. I think when we engage the contractors, the electrical contractors, we know that there is some union representation with some of the contractors in town. Not all of our electrical contractors are in town are union.
Correct.
But that's a great point, and we'll certainly bring that into the mix.
It's just been a relationship that has continued to get better and better, and I just think, my opinion, an outreach, just to inform and include, might have benefits.
Sure. Great suggestion.
To everybody.
And if I can just take that one step further, there's a gentleman who represents the greater IBEW for the state of Washington, who is their lobbyist, that I've been chatting with, and I'd like to put you in touch with. So let's chat a little offline on that.
Great suggestions. Thank you. Some additional staff actions. We know that we've got HDL customers down in the residential all the way up through the commercial and industrial, and we need to establish new metering for all of them. So we're actively looking at what opportunities we have to meter these folks in a little bit of a non-traditional way. This looks like a little bit more of an automated metering so that we can get that hourly consumption read and understand their load profiles. So we're actively evaluating the technologies as to how we can meter these the best we can. We also recognize that as HDL customers come in and move around, we know that there's a migration from rate class to rate class, and we want to make sure that we're clarifying those processes on where a traditional commercial customer exists. If they migrate into the HDL rate, we want to make sure that we have that process laid out well and communicated clearly. We also know that there's a variety of reporting that we need to manage and maintain internally, and we're going to be working with strategic financial planning and other areas to develop some of the processes for reporting on HDL customers on a regular basis, and I'm sure some of that information you would be interested in after a year or so. We want to notify the HDL application process to all internal and external stakeholders, and I mentioned earlier we see an opportunity to work with the city municipalities, the county. When an HDL business comes into a town or a city, we would like it if the municipals would essentially require them to say, look, you need to talk to the PUD. You need to inform them of what you're doing. So we're going to look for opportunities to share in the application process with them as well. And then finally, we want to, as I mentioned before, we've got the $190 per megawatt approved in the resolution. And just we need to develop those processes to make sure that we are consistent in our application of that. So we'll be working on that as well. This is a look at our timeline. So, again, this is just a recommendation at this point in time. No action is required today, but this is kind of what we're thinking is continue that moratorium through December 31st of 2016. And starting sometime in October, again, we want to develop that application queue or start receiving those applications, but at minimum, develop a queue. And a queue would look like, hey, I'm an applicant. Here's specifically where I want to locate, and here's specifically how much energy I need at that location. And it gives us an opportunity to evaluate those impacts. But again, no customer would be, under this recommendation, would be energized until January 1 of 2017. When the HDL rate goes into effect. And then, of course, a large spectrum of stakeholder engagement between now and that time frame.
As a memory refresher, the current moratorium expires on what day?
Right now, there's a hearing set up for October 3rd to make a determination to extend to take action. So that'll be scheduled for that board meeting. Just wanted to, Andy did a nice job walking through it, but that queue that's being discussed, we certainly recognize that there could be some interest, and really until the rate is in place and we have the ability to charge that upfront fee, we want to make sure we have the proper authority, but we still want to know and get a priority. Certainly if somebody comes in and they have more specific information, that will help them in that queue. So when January rolls around and they're ready to take the next step and everything's in place, there's some order to that process.
Commissioners, I just want to clarify that so the moratorium will continue until it's lifted by the board. The next action date or consideration date is that October 3rd, and you all have already set it for that date. So there's no further action other than it'll appear on your agenda as a hearing. Okay.
Thank you. Additional questions? Yeah.
When we talk about the HDL, about new applicants that qualify, do we have any current customers today that actually qualify for the HDL rate that have not been I mean, I guess they're on the system. They're drawing the power. They would qualify today if we lift the moratorium. So do we have those kind of customers, and how many are there, and how will the last bullet point on this, the $190 per kilowatt, does that, how would that affect those people?
So I can take a stab at that.
Sure.
We recognize that we have a little bit of a moving number as far as the total number of HDL customers. We believe there's around 15. We're still in the process of trying to look at those, but we think we've got the major ones, particularly the large ones.
They would qualify right now.
They would qualify right now. The majority of those recognize that they will be fit into the HDL. We're working on communications with the ones that either have not came and participated or have been here and been relatively silent. So we are working on communications with them. It is my understanding that the existing HDL customers will not be impacted for their existing loads relative to the $190 per kW. However, if those existing HDL customers wish to increase their load, they would be affected unless we've negotiated in a contract with them, which I believe there's a handful of them that Eric's done. So an HDL customer would be subject, an existing customer would be subject to the $190 per kW if they wanted to increase.
Okay, so I'm just assuming the infrastructure is already there then to supply that load and service that load.
Yeah, not necessarily. And that's part of the application process. In fact, any customer wishing to change their load or increase their load is required to provide a new application to the district and outline specifically what their energy requirements will be. And at that point in time, we'll evaluate the infrastructure to make sure that we have...
But that's only on increase or change. But I'm talking about the existing load today with no change. Are they impacted at all?
The existing load today, with no change, they would not be impacted. We do continually monitor the energy usage, and there are times where it's necessary to make some small improvements in wire size or transformer sizes. But for the most part, the existing ones would not be impacted.
So, Commissioner Mahoney, I agree with virtually everything Andy said. My only caveat to that, and we're still working on developing some of those policies, is that sometimes these particular loads are always not forthcoming in terms of where they are or that they are in that particular type of use. So there is some potential that if there's a load out there that's existing that we don't know about, we've not been told about, and creates system problems, there will be the potential to impose some of the new policies on those folks. And that's the application for changed and increased service really applies across the district rate classifications. It's not unique to the HDL. But for varying reasons, these folks move about and or don't tell us exactly what it is they're doing, and that can create and does create system problems for Andy's team. And we find them all kinds of various ways, unfortunately often by system failure.
This does speak to, we are entering a new era, and I think as Andy has touched on, the reporting processes that are put in place, field intelligence, things of that nature, so we really put a closer eye on monitoring what these loads are and where they're at.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Any questions from the public? Thank you.
Thanks.
And John, you can just stay there.
So I want to ask, do we want to turn the light off if that's the light issue?
Yeah, really? I don't think, is it distracting?
No, it's not that distracting. No,
Sheila, let's...
I think the recording...
Okay. Can't pick us up unless you're an inch from the microphone.
On this agenda item... we're going to be reporting on the changes that occurred in the balance scorecard, but there were two exceptions to that, items 10 and 12. It was requested by the managing directors to give an update on items 10 and 12, even though there wasn't a change on the balance scorecard. And then to the degree that you all had questions about any of the items, you know, feel free to ask any questions about the items, even if there weren't changes as well. So the first item on the balanced scorecard that is on the list is item 10, and Mike Coleman's going to give the update on that.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. The reason we wanted to highlight this one, it is the same as the first quarter, but there were actually incidents in both the first and the second quarter that involved outages on the network. Back on March 28th, we were conducting upgrades of all of the core switches in the network. There's seven of them. And when we went to upgrade the sixth switch out of seven, they made some routine changes in the afternoon that should not have been service affecting, but they turned out to be service affecting. That was a combination of a software bug and a card that was going defective in that switch. So that was resolved over the next week or two. And then on April the 18th, 17th and 18th, we started experiencing a memory buffer overflow in the optical line terminal shells, and that also turned out to be a software bug. And it was the case of a unexpected packet coming from the core switches to the OLTs not recognizing what to do with it because of the software bug. That ultimately led to some minor outages, but they occurred over several days until we could figure out what the bug was. We implemented a workaround policy, which set maintenance windows every 12 to 14 days to reboot the OLTs and clear the memory buffers. The good news is that through all of this, we've now cleared the software bugs that were involved with this. The hardware was changed out. And so we've been running at above the metric since then. The bad news is because we're trying to operate at 5 nines, and that is our target, it doesn't take but 5.25 minutes of outage to run you for the year when you measure against 5 nines. So although we measure hundreds of elements within the network, we accumulated enough outage time through those combined software and hardware failures that it's going to stay red for the remainder of the year. However, this did cause us to have some conversation about overall redundancy in the network, and that's specifically what I wanted to address. We've taken advantage and created redundancy and resiliency everywhere that it's economically feasible within the network. An example is from Wenatchee to Chelan, we're utilizing fiber on both sides of the river to create a redundant path. I think we all remember in the fires last year that did us no good because both paths ultimately got burned going to Chelan, both at Chelan Falls and on Route 97. So when we look at our network, we have the ability, using those redundant paths, to automatically switch when we have a failure in a single path. What we're very much aware of is that throughout the network, we also have places in the county that we don't have but one path. An example of that is Upper Valley. We have a single set of fibers going from Wenatchee through Cashmere to Leavenworth and on up to Lake Wenatchee. And at this point, it's not feasible to create that redundancy simply because of the cost of creating a redundant path over the mountains. We've had estimates anywhere from $15 to $20 million to create that one single leg of redundancy. So we operate knowing that when we have failures in that type of a situation, we have to immediately start figuring out how to reestablish connectivity, and that's going to be dependent upon the circumstances that caused that failure. So my overall message is we do look at and practice all of the best methods for gaining redundancy in the network, but we're each aware that we have areas that don't have redundancy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
And the next six items are Kirk.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Next item is hydro availability, item number 11. We aren't hitting our targets there at 75.8% for the second quarter, due mainly to B1 through 4 at Rock Island, as well as the generator issues we've been having at Rocky Reach on C10. Those are the main drivers for us not meeting our targets there. That one will stay red for the remainder of the year because B1 through 4 will be out for the remainder of the year. Item 12 is actually one of the exceptions Greg talked about. It's green in both quarters, but I wanted to discuss that just briefly. If you looked at the first quarter report, you'd find that it was colored red. And there's one main reason for that. We had our employee that was calculating the transmission availability was out for medical leave. So we had others step in to do the calculation, and they were calculating everything that had an impact on the transmission system. The industry standard is that you calculate only those impacts that have impacts to customers. We take transmission lines down for outages, for maintenance outages that don't impact customers because of the redundancy that Mike was talking about. So we were calculating everything, even if we took it down and we had the redundancy. So now that we've corrected the calculation, you see it's green in both quarters.
So, Kirk, before you leave that one, is it a sign of the times that you have to operate with 4 9s and Mike has to operate with 5 9s?
I get more than 5 minutes. And I'm glad. 5 minutes is pretty tough. The next one, item number 16, reinvesting in our hydros. This one along with, so item 16A and item 16C are red this quarter. Main impact here is the schedule to the C8 long-term turbine repair. You recall, we asked the board to declare an emergency earlier this year on the head covers for the large units at Rocky Reach. And so while we're in the midst of repairing C8, and we've had to go out, order new head covers, and those have yet to arrive. So it's delaying that schedule from completing C8 at the end of this year to May next year. So A and C are red as a result. Next item is our hydro asset management efforts. Item 18A and B. They are yellow this quarter. The first one is a maturity model metric that we have. We actually set ourselves a target of 3.06 on the model. When our employees actually filled out the survey that would come up with the numbers, we grade ourselves really hard. In fact, the target was set by a consultant that helps clients with their asset management programs throughout the world. And they thought we would be in the 3 range, but our employees put us at a range that's around 2.86. So we're very hard graders on ourselves, which is a good place to be, or 2.83, excuse me. That's the number that our employees came up with.
May I interrupt? Have we seen that model, that asset management program maturity model?
No. In fact, we're scheduled to come back this fall and give the board an overview of our asset management efforts across the district.
Oh, cool.
Good. Yeah.
I just wasn't really familiar with it.
Yeah, you haven't seen that.
Good.
Next item, item B, strategic asset management plan. That's in the generation area. We had a target of June 30th to complete that. The people that were working on that, we had to divert to all the efforts on the hydro reinvestments with the B1 through 4 analysis as well as the repair strategy schedule. So we temporarily diverted those employees to help get the B1 through 4 evaluation done. They're back on it now. In fact, we are complete with this now. So you will see that show up later. So we've made good progress there since June 30th.
And the next four are John Stoll.
John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Item number 24, the Advanced Intelligent Grid Capabilities. We had a goal by 6:30 to establish a customer involvement topic team, but recognizing with it, all the activities around the CIS and the meter data management, that has taken priority. So we have not established that. With the help of Suzanne Hartman and others, though, we have been developing materials and communications, so when we do reach that point, we're ready to go.
John, may I interrupt?
Sure.
So how are you going to do that? How are you going to involve customers? Just randomly choose?
Well, actually, what we're kind of moving forward, we're kind of crawling and walking before we run on this topic, and recognizing that there's a timing, and the CIS replacement project is the priority right now. But we still want to gather that input. So you may recall from the customer satisfaction survey, we got some great feedback to work with, and that led to developing more of a communication to work with what I would call maybe key folks around the district, maybe people in the local municipals.
That's my question. How are you going to choose the people to involve?
Well, we might ask them other recommendations. So if
I do have some names.
So great, yeah.
I submit from the Chelan area. These are customers that both Andrew and I have met with who have concerns about the intelligence grid.
Okay.
So well, I'd love to see them on that team.
Sure. When we get to that point, we'll.
I will propose them, and then you go from there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyhow, we're still kind of doing some work behind the scenes, but again, we don't want to take away any focus from the CIS that is currently underway. The second one is number 25, and that's the develop and implement a strategy to protect the regional water supply and seek regional operational efficiencies among entities. So as you've been aware, we've been looking at a second regional source. We're making good progress, but we were made aware that the area down around Rock Island is considered a culturally sensitive site. So with that, there was a survey that needed to take place. So there was field work done, and right now the consultants who performed that are developing the report. So until we get that report, that's kind of pushed off doing any further work on that site. So that's why B has gone from green to red. The other piece following on that is to further understand the financial impacts of a second source to regional membership. We have that by the end of November. That's gone to yellow, just again recognizing that cultural survey results and the subsequent test drilling of the area have been delayed, but it still is a potential to hit that date. And then the last one that I have is on number 26, on executing on capital plans, scheduling within budget. We were at red first quarter. We've changed to green. We've caught up. I think we're at a 93% estimate to completing our capital budget.
Thank you, Mike. I've got the next item, and I have just the opposite situation from John. I went from green to red. The lack of spending on telecom system improvement projects will keep the target red for the remainder of 2016. The fiber system is forecasted to be fully spent, but is being overshadowed by the decreased telecom project spend. And I will touch on the telecom projects before that change a little bit more in item 61.
I've got the next two. Item number 28, we had on our performance plan this year to conduct a feasibility study, if you will, on alternative oil for the juvenile fish bypass. This one is shaded yellow just because we fell behind early in the year. We have got a project manager identified, and we are putting that back on track. We should have that one done by the end of the year. And item number 29 is... this was a stretch target we set to identify all sources of oil at the hydros and identify the greatest risks to spill. That one we have not made progress on, and that is similar to the other ones I reported on, that we've diverted a lot of resources on the hydros because of all the major hydro repair work, particularly B1 through 4, that wasn't planned at the beginning of this year.
I have the next two. Item 31 is complete the Dryden wastewater capital improvements. Item A was the achieve grant funding process results by 7/31. We did see the early results. Unfortunately, it didn't meet the expectations of receiving grant money. It was primary loan to help fund that project. That, coupled with increasing capital costs of this project, has caused us to take a pause, start engaging ecology as we look for solutions to put in place a sustainable, cost-effective solution. So, again, that's red, and we're kind of developing a new path forward as it sits. That leads into B, which is pending funding, complete a 60% collection system of the system design by year end. That's been put into yellow, and frankly, since that, we've made the decision to actually stop the design process till we know more. We were in a good spot to do that, so that most likely will be red.
And this is Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources. I have the next two, which are items 41A and 41D. This is for the Mid-Sea Hourly Coordination Agreement. Just so you know, the existing hourly coordination is set to expire in June of 2017. We're in the process of updating that agreement with the other PUDs and Bonneville. And so far we've reached a good agreement with the other PUDs. We just don't have anything in writing signed off and saying that they agree to the terms that we've developed jointly. So we've modified it from a green until the yellow until we get a kind of a signed agreement as to what those design principles are going to be. So far, we've developed an agreement in principle. We've developed the process for executing that, and we've also developed the outline for the new agreement as well. So we're making good progress. We would just like to see a commitment by the other PUDs and Bonneville and get something in writing. That's why it's yellow.
And I'm up next, Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial Risk Officer. I'm on page 11, item number 55, for developing and continuing to implement our business continuity plans. So as Kirk mentioned, also the we have certain goals that are designated as stretch goals. The stretch goals are important goals that we want to complete, and they have important benefits that we want to achieve. But we also recognize that we want to complete these goals without sacrificing the progress on our primary goals and our core duties. So stretch goals are identified as those goals that we would delay if push comes to shove and we need the same resources to accomplish the necessary progress on our core activities and our primary goals. So business continuity is one of those. And how we recognize that these are stretch goals is that should they need to be delayed, we don't indicate them as red, recognizing that those are the ones that we would like to delay in the priority of choices in order to accomplish the higher priority ones. So business continuity is one of those that's indicated as yellow, but we are going to delay the accomplishment of some of those timelines, specifically the Q2 ones at this point. There are a couple areas that had some Q2 goals that aren't going to be accomplished. We're going to do a variance with Steve Wright, general manager, to put a new due date on those for completing them by the end of the year. We also anticipate that a few areas will need the same type of variance for their Q3 goals. So you'll notice that 55A, B, and C are all indicated as yellow, in anticipation that this stretch goal will have variances to set a new target date of by the end of the year for all three of those that are indicated there.
I have one question. It's probably obvious for everybody, but not for me. But when does a stretch goal turn red?
It doesn't. That's okay. Part of the way that we've defined stretch goals.
Oh, okay.
So, I'll give you a little insight into why we did that. So, nobody wants to have anything that's red. We're all working hard here to ensure that we achieve our schedule. And so, as you can tell by all of us, we do everything we can to accomplish these goals. The stretch goals are those that are on the list because we want to push ourselves to accomplish everything we can, but recognizing that everything isn't going to be able to be accomplished in our very aggressive plans. So, the not having stretch goals be indicated as red is that middle ground to help us make good choices of what are the right things to delay, should they need to be delayed, so we can have quality results on our primary goals and our core duties. So that's why we have a middle ground for stretch goals. They are only indicated as yellow when we need to delay them.
Thank you.
I have the next one under number 60, maintain and update utility service policies to be responsive to changing circumstances. Similar to Kelly, we have some stretch goals in there. So we have three of them. They're bullets C and D and E, and they're actually the first one, C, was develop distributed generation rate alternatives by Q2. Due to the efforts around the high density load policy and rates, that really kind of took a bit of a backseat. Work has gone on. We actually are currently in the process of reviewing a white paper around kind of the current state of the industry and where distributed generation alternatives stand. So that is, again, yellow because we did have a Q2 a date for that. The next one, present distributed generation recommendations to the senior management team, is scheduled for Q3. That's yellow, but again, we still continue to push through and work on this these rate alternatives to further understand them.
Mike?
Okay, item 61, executing the district telecommunications systems improvement plans by 1231. Telecom resource availability has impacted all three of the telecom projects. The current PBX RFP was canceled to incorporate integration requirements to other district systems. When we made a decision to change the technology that the PBX platform was going to be on, that required us to go back and look at the integration issues with several other district systems to include the corporate IT network. The microwave and trunk radio, both are being impacted by the lack of resources, the availability of resources, and so all three projects have been slid. The trunk radio system is a stretch goal, but it has been slid to the 2017-2018 time. The microwave communications, we've completed the feasibility study, and as a result of that, we're going to use some contract labor to go ahead and do the site work, which will position us for being able to move on with the projects in 2017 and 2018. The PBX RFP is still being developed. We're exploring various alternatives to actually move that forward from the original delay, but in all, it is going to be delayed into 2017, and it is going to continue to impact our capital spending.
Mike, are you saying then, I'm just looking for clarification, that there's a part of the delay is due to manufacturer availability of equipment?
No, it's not a question of the availability of the equipment. It's a question of the availability of engineering resources that we have. We are literally down to nothing on telecom resources right now for various reasons. And although we're utilizing some contract resources, and we particularly will use contract resources for some of the make-ready work, just having the engineers on staff and available is the primary delay.
I have the next one under item 62, the upgrade the customer information system, including incorporating intelligent grid requirements. Sub-bullet A actually changed from yellow to green. We got a bit of a late start of kind of going through our requirements, but once the team got together and got through the roughly 4,000 requirements, there was the opportunity to evaluate all the potential functionality. So we actually got that done by Q2. So that one, again, has changed from yellow to green. Item B, issuing the RFP, the request for proposal by August 31st. First, that is still yellow, just pending. It's a tight time frame. The draft is currently being written, but still, there's a lot to go through to get to that August 31st. So that's still yellow. We do know, though that under C, the select the software vendor by 11:30. That will be red through year end. We know once the RFP goes out, there's a time frame allotted. There's an evaluation. Then the short list is brought in, and you have on site vendor demos. So ultimately, we're looking at late Q1, Q2 of 2017 to have that software selected.
And Ron Franklin is stepping in for Lorna on item 68, A, B, and C.
Ron Franklin, Director of Safety and Health. We're talking about 68. This is the safety metrics A, B, and C. hearing loss. We also had some ergonomics that we felt like it was carpal tunnel that sprung up on us. And we addressed those by upgrading some of our training. We also brought in a medical specialist in ergonomics to our safety meetings, recorded that, made available to our employees, and also worked with ergonomics with individual workstations and also working with our tools. Lost time, again, that's another one that we had set at was at 0.48, it was actually 0.61. These numbers, as we say, and they're also the DART, which is days weight restricted, and the incident, all correlate. They all have elements of the same metrics that figure into that. So if you have one is affected, it'll affect the other two in there. So that's part of what led to that. And then the days away were a goal of 1.05 or 1.52. We know, like as I said, that we set that goal based on last year, and we're going to be pretty high marks to achieve that. We also are concerned about some of the non-injuries. We had some of these were not recordable, but they were springing up as being reported. We could turn into recordable. One thing we're trying to do too is look at what's the bigger picture? How do we address some of these things and not get down to the weeds and try to look at specific injuries, but more of a holistic look of culture change, culture shift, and mindset and people's attitudes. And Kirk is going to speak a little bit more about that in terms of the human performance and then a system of employees engaging in that. It's something that we feel like that we have a great potential to move us closer to safety excellence.
Any questions from commissioners?
Excuse me, I had one more there that was the attendance. Union attendance. That's something we've been really following closely. And we really thought that important. We want all employees to feel as though they have an opportunity to engage in and talk about safety and be able to give safety information. We set a 70% goal, and we've been words on that one, and we hit it at the end of May, but in June, the month there, we had a month that we had some great tribute to people being away from work. We had some other activities going on in the district that took people away. One thing we tried to mitigate that by is we video these safety meetings. We also give the agendas to be able to have their safety minute or safety meeting at their staff meeting. So we tried to give them other avenues of being able to address that. And that's something that we've had some great success with. I'm very confident that we'll be able to, by the, as we transition to the end of the year, we'll be able to reach that number. We're very close. We're in our trending is moving in the right direction. So hopefully we'll be able to do that and have all the employees feel like that they are getting that information on a monthly basis.
I have a question, Ron. You know, talking about attendance, you know, and knowing that we have, you know, certain times of the year where there's more vacations than others, and we have a track record of that. We know that. And so I'm just curious why we don't alter our goal during certain times of the month and say, well, should it be 70%? Maybe it should be 65%. I don't know. It's just because typically at this time of year, we don't have the employees here. So it's like an impossible goal to meet if they're not here to attend the meeting. Is there any way to adjust for that, or do you adjust for it? I don't know.
We have not. We take a position. We're going to be steady about that. We know we're going to have these ups and downs.
Okay.
But by overall, it'll average itself out. Also, as I said, is we have, if they are gone for whatever reason, they do have ability to make that up in another fashion. They can attend another meeting. They got the video they could watch. They can have it in their staff meeting.
That makes sense.
It's more than just they missed one.
Okay, that makes sense. I clarified it. Thanks.
Any additional questions for any of the presenters? Any questions from any member of the audience? Thank you.
The next item is Kirk Hudson's going to talk about high reliability operations. He has a presentation.
It's the one. I got it. Thank you.
Good morning, Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. This morning, presentation on high reliability operations is information and education only, not requesting any action here. Just want to give you a feel for what we're learning about high reliability operations, where we're headed, to kind of put this in context of a picture and where we're at on this journey. I would say, using an example of hiking or backpacking, normally when I go on a backpacking trip, I know where my destination is, and I've got my maps and my supplies all lined out. I know where the trailhead's at, and putting together a plan to get from point A to point B. At this point, we're not even at the trailhead at high reliability operations. So I wanted to put that picture on it from the standpoint of we know we're going to go on a journey here. We know this isn't an overnight trip. This is going to be a long trip. It's going to be Pacific Crest Trail-like in terms of a lot of the logistics, long road, years, and it's not an overnight thing. So we started learning about what's called human performance. You might have heard that term. We hear that in the utility industry. We mainly hear it from the reliability compliance side of things. Our regulators on the reliability compliance side have talked about human performance over the last 3 years when they've investigated large cascading type transmission outages, and they drill back to find out where the root cause was, and they find that many times it has to do with human error. And so they've been really focusing on what they call human performance, which is managing the human error side of things. As we've learned more about human performance, we've learned high reliability operations is a term that we like even better than human performance, because it's not just focused on human errors. It's focused on five key principles, and I'll explain those and define high reliability operations. But it's more than reliability. It includes reliability, it includes compliance, productivity, quality, and safety. And that's why we like it. It's broader than just one piece of it. So we've been talking over the last 12 months to a number of experts in the field. You see their pictures up on the screen. One thing we've learned is there's a lot of different approaches. And so there's not one particular person that we've consulted with that has all the answers. So we've been talking to a number of them to try and put the puzzle together on high reliability operations. We've invited each one of the individuals on the screen to come here and talk to us, except for the one on the bottom right there. We are in the process of talking to him as we speak. I've talked to him in person a number of times. But they're all individuals that we're working with and consulting with on high reliability operations and human performance, and they're scattered throughout the country. The big aha for us as we've educated ourselves and learned more about this concept is that there's no silver bullet in terms of operating a utility for high reliability operations. It's not a program you buy. It's not one person you consult with to come in and that you pay and help you do something. It's a mindset that you're after, and we're after it from a number of aspects, including from employees to managers. And the mindset is described as the following. Quality is king, getting it right above getting it done. Chronic uneasiness, which is recognizing that you should always be a little bit uneasy about what you're doing, especially in an industry like we have. High hazards, high voltage, very dangerous, extreme heights. You should always be a little bit uneasy about that. Continuous improvement, learning as a way of life, high personal discipline with humility, and innovation focus. That's the mindset that we're after under a high reliability operations effort.
And Kirk, just kind of going back to the chronic uneasiness, anxiety can be positive or negative. And this is a positive anxiety.
very much so. Yeah. It's you want to be confident, you don't want to be overconfident and miss the dangers that are there because of your overconfidence. So well put. So the term I threw out earlier, human performance, it's actually defined in the information as behavior of an individual to accomplish a certain result. And there's five key principles for the human performance efforts, and that is recognizing, one, that people make errors. No matter what you do, you can't drive that out of the picture. People do make mistakes. The second principle is our response to failure matters. The third one, individual behaviors are influenced. Number four, operational upsets can be avoided. And number five, error-likely situations are predictable. So the idea behind this is recognizing people will make errors, but you can influence how people perform their work, and you can actually predict when situations are more ripe for errors than others. As an illustration, I'll show you, this is what they call the human error precursors matrix. And I won't go into all of these, but of interesting note, this is that bullet point five, where error likely situations are predictable. There's four different categories of where humans are likely to make an error. It's either associated with task demands, individual capabilities, human nature, and then the work environment. The studies show that, and I encourage you, you can just try this yourself. Studies show that the average person makes 4 to 5 errors an hour. And if you keep track of that, I think you will confirm that. I've done it myself over the last several months. I'll just take an hour and I'll just try and keep track of just simple things where an error is made. And I think that number is about right on, if not low. But it's interesting to note that, and you'll see how that comes into play a little bit later. One thing here, we've started looking at this error matrix. When we have events or incidents in our operation, we look here and see if any of these were present when we look back. And of interest, you're aware of the three significant events we had in the generation and transmission area last year. We found that there were three of these that were actually present in all three incidents. One of them is this one down here in the work environment, changes, departures from routine. In each of those cases, there was something that changed along the way. Work was scheduled, work was planned to be done a certain way, and something changed. Another one that we saw, and this gets to one of your points, Commissioner Bowles, was this complacency, overconfidence one. We saw that as we talked to employees involved. It wasn't a complacency, it was the overconfidence piece. It was, we've done this a number of times. We've done it just perfect a number of times, and I didn't necessarily have the chronic uneasiness associated with that job for the 1,000th time. The other one is the assumptions, and you'll see this in the next slide too. Just the important, there were a lot of assumptions. There were a lot of assumptions made in the incidents we saw. Great employees, long tenured, assume certain things were done a certain way, worked with, you know, each other for many years, and it was never done a different way, and but things were different that day. So we've gotten a lot of use out of this. It definitely portrays that, okay, there's situations where you can recognize when you see these pop up that you're more likely to have an error happen. So very useful tool for us. High reliability operations principles. So I'll read you the definition. I read you the definition of human performance. I'll read you the definition of high reliability operations, and tell me if this doesn't fit with what we do here. High reliability, this is describing an organization. A high reliability organization is defined as an organization that operates in an unforgiving social and political environment, rich with the potential for error, where the scale of consequences precludes learning through experimentation, and where complex processes are used to manage complex technology in order to avoid failure. So wow. With 230,000 bolts, very high transmission structures, distribution, heavy equipment, hydro generation with 100 feet of water pressure behind it, operating a dam on the Columbia River. That describes us pretty well. Not a lot of forgiveness under that kind of equipment and the high hazard operations we have. And it's not something that you want to learn by experimentation. You want to know you have your processes and you want to know that they're right. The five principles associated with high reliability operations are sensitive to operations. Each employee pays close attention to operations and maintains awareness as to what is or isn't working. There are no assumptions. Reluctant to accept simple explanations for principles is principle number two. Ask a lot of questions. Keep digging until you find the specific source of the problem. Number three, preoccupation with failure. Think of ways work processes might break down. Number four, defer to expertise. Listen to the people who have the most developed knowledge of the task at hand. It's usually the people right on the front line performing the work. Resilient, prepared in how to respond to failures and continually find new solutions. We're after all five of those. That's the journey that we're going to embark on here.
I would comment that those five are a map for life, too.
Yeah, very much so. One of the things we're learning along the way is this concept of drift. And this has gotten a lot of attraction here. And one of the things that this figure on the screen displays here is that you have a standard. It's this green line at the top. And we set a very high standard and a bar for ourselves. It's very high. And you name it, in terms of safety performance, customer service, operations, reliability to the customer. It's a very high standard. One of the things that's always out there is you have this threat of not achieving that standard that you've set for yourself. It could be associated with error precursors. It could be some things you don't have any control over. But one of the things that this shows is it's human nature to eventually, you set the standard really high and you work towards meeting that standard day in and day out. It's human nature to deviate from that. Find out that you can do things, you can take a shortcut, you can get the same result if you take a shortcut. You might have 10 steps in a procedure. Maybe the first one doesn't apply here. Maybe I can get the job done, 2 minutes faster if I don't do this without a big risk. Well, if that goes unchecked, that will continue to deviate and drift until you hit the point where those two collide and you have something, an event, if you will, or an incident. And you always look back and you say, wow, how did we get from here to here? And you can see the little things along the way that you've allowed to have happen. We've actually, a number of managers have this on their wall as a reminder that when they see little things, let's get back to the bar. Because those will eventually contribute to an event or an incident. Accident systems thinking, this has to do with the high reliability operations. This is really important. This is probably one of the big takeaways for us, is that great performance is not the absence of errors. As we talked about earlier, human errors will occur. It's the presence of defenses, that you actually have a system in place. When those errors happen, you catch them. You have mitigation set up so that they do not cause a disruption to operations. This quote came from Todd Conklin, and he's one of the speakers we've listened to. He wrote a book very popular in the industry called Pre-Accident Investigations, going back prior to the accident occurring to find out what you have to have in place for defenses set up. Along the lines of the systems thinking, one of the things we're really paying attention to is that individual behavior is driven by a lot of things. It's not always just the individual. It's driven by a lot of local factors, the culture, the organization. There's a lot of things that go on. What people do makes perfect sense to them at the time. There's a whole bunch of other factors that contribute to what it is that they're actually doing. This slide represents, there's a term in the industry that they often use in human performance and high reliability operations, is the need to have a just culture. I've talked to a lot of different people trying to get a clear definition of what just culture is, and every time I do, I get a little different answer or a different twist on it. But so this one we put together ourselves, which is kind of the just culture is the sweet spot. And you talk to many people who will say, if you have a culture of individual blame, then you don't have a just culture. Then you'll talk to the other end of the spectrum that says, the organization is always the problem, not the individual. Our particular take on it is that you have to recognize you both have the individual effort and you also have the organizational influences. It's not always one or the other. It's somewhere in the middle. Just as an illustration for what this just culture picture looks like, it's moving from asking who did something to how did something happen. It's actually moving from to with our employees. It's learning from events, and it's the employees on the front line performing the work seen as the problem solvers, not the problem. It's creating a reporting culture where you actually get your results and your metrics might actually go down because you're getting everything reported. Oftentimes, just when you go through the green and red, yellow exercise, that comes with, you know, people anxiety levels in terms of, boy, should I report this or not report this? Is this rise to that level or not? But it moves from a culture to we're going to report everything and we're going to err on the side of reporting everything, even if we don't think it's important to get back to that standard that we've set for ourselves. The only way you can get back to that standard is if you have the reporting. Recognizing and addressing those organizational and local factors, and then growing real accountability in the organization. So how do you grow a new culture? I would have to say, I want to acknowledge right off the bat that this by no means means we don't have these elements in place. They're, in some cases, they're there and they're good. In other cases, they're not. We have a lot of improvement that we can definitely reap the benefits from, and that's what we're after. So the culture is plant some seeds, tend to the vine, root out the problems, and reap the harvest. So next steps for us in this high reliability operations effort is to continue learning. We have a team of employees down in Texas today actually benchmarking with another utility. They learned about them at a conference in Colorado, and they invited them down to actually see how they did their assessments, and so that's happening today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. We do have plans to train all supervisors in generation and transmission by the end of the third quarter, and then we've got focused efforts on creating that learning environment, really after how do we take these events, how do we take things that haven't turned into events, and how do we learn from them, and how do we prevent accidents and incidents from happening in the first place. And then we're focused on pre-task planning. A lot of this that we've learned has a lot to do with before a task is starting, taking the time, much like the hike that I used as an illustration at the beginning of this, was the more time you take planning up front, the more successful you're going to be. If you can recognize and remind employees that here's the task, here's the roles and responsibilities, and here are the error likely situations that we might encounter. So if these things happen, to stop, that's going to be really important for our success. So that's it in a nutshell. Just wanted to share what we're learning and where we're headed in this regard. Any questions?
Dennis.
Yeah, I guess not a question, but a comment. First of all, I'd like to congratulate everyone for moving in this direction. But I'd also like to compliment you for what I would feel the most difficult thing is to do you've already done. So the rest of it is refinement. The engineer, philosopher, social gadfly, Buck Minister Fuller oftentimes said the most difficult thing to change is your mind. And so if you can change the mindset and start reviewing your culture, that's the most difficult thing to do. And so So now it's a refinement of that, that the change in the mindset. So thank you.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions? I guess I'd like to say that what I saw you put on today is probably one of the most powerful potential game changers for our utility that, that may exist, and that's the people and how we change those minds. I went through many, many years ago leadership training, and many of the elements here are components in what how you become a leader is. And this is part of that process, and so it's powerful. Thank you. Questions from the audience? Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Keep after it.
Thank you.
Nice job.
Let me just do one more.
Okay.
You know, we had a young lady who spoke this morning, Emily Bocco, and her grandfather was a phenomenal leader, saw things differently than most. During his eulogy, one of his former players, Tommy Thompson, and it's under the category recognize and reduce our procedures, our precursors, the assumptions, the inaccurate mental picture. And Tommy was walking off the field one day after practice as a senior and then leader on the team. And he'd been running the Bothell method since he was a seventh grader. At one of the junior highs at that time. And they had finished up by running a series of offensive plays. And he said to his coach, "My God, Mr. Bofto, Coach Bofto, why do we keep running those plays every night?" He said, "We know them." And he said, "Tommy, you don't run them because you know them. You run them because you need to know when something's different." And I think when you look at our assumptions oftentimes lead us to an inaccurate mental picture. When you run that play 1,000 times, you know when it's different, and that's when you need to take a different action. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, here's a guy out of Montana. Some people saw as a, you know, just as a coach, but tremendous philosopher and saw things differently. And I think that's one of the reasons why his teams were successful is they knew when things were different than how to respond. So anyway, that struck a chord, but how fortuitous that his grandfather.
Yeah. Good illustration. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for Kirk? Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So the agenda item 7 is alternative fuel requirements, and Craig Weddle is going to talk about that.
Good morning, Commissioners. Craig Weddle, Supply Chain and Fleet Manager for the District. And I want to give you a brief update this morning on our alternative fuel requirements for the District's fleet. Mostly, I want to spend a little bit of time telling you about a new biodiesel product that we're planning to use in our fleet called Renewable Diesel, or R99. The picture on the front of the presentation gives you a little hint on what's to come. The renewable diesel, as compared to the standard petroleum diesel, you can see how much cleaner it burns. So that's sort of the theme of this, what I'm going to tell you about. So again, just to be a quick update on the status of alternative fuel requirements for the fleet, talk about what we're doing currently and where we're headed with this, and there's no action required of the board on this. It's just information at this point on where we're headed with this. Getting ahead of myself. So just as a reminder, refresher, RCW 43-19-648 requires the district and other public municipal fleets in the state of Washington to satisfy 100% of our fuel usage with electricity or biofuel by June 1st of 2018. We've been waiting on the Department of Commerce for probably almost 2 years now to develop a set of rules to sort of define the practicability of actually complying with this statute. And they now have come out with those rules, and I'm actually pleased to say that they're pretty common sense. They're establishing a 20% biodiesel level requirement. So we're currently running a 5% biodiesel mix and with all of our diesel. This requirement would require us to go to 20% minimum on that in terms of the biodiesel percentage in our diesel fuel. A couple other key points to the rules that they have come out with. They do not require us to replace any asset before the end of its normal useful life in order to comply with this statute. So that's good news. They do not require you to buy anything that doesn't meet your operational needs first. And they do not require you to buy anything that has a life cycle cost basically greater than what you would have otherwise purchased. So in other words, they're not going to force us to buy electric vehicles or hybrid electric vehicles to comply with this if those don't meet our operational needs or they have a life cycle cost greater than what we would otherwise buy. So that's all good news. It's common sense stuff. Yes, sir.
Craig, does that extend then to lawnmowers, weed trimmers? What about our fleet of boats for the marine fishery? Does that extend to that area?
Vessels, it extends to everything we operate, basically. The statute is just what's shown here, vessels, vehicles, and construction equipment.
We're not going to have to buy diesel lawnmowers?
No, sir. No, we're not. Right. No. It doesn't appear so.
All right, yeah. Good.
We are actually buying some electric lawnmowers, but that's another story we've talked about before. So, so what I mainly want to talk to you about, so as this statute and this requirement is coming at us, is a driver for looking at other types of alternative biofuels, basically. And there's a relatively new product out called renewable diesel, or R99. That's an alternative to the typical biodiesel that we've been seeing, and we've been running at 5%. And so I want to talk to you about the differences here between the new renewable diesel, which we've been, which we're looking to transition to in our fleet, and we have been testing, versus the standard biodiesel that we've been running for some time. So both are made from vegetable oils and animal fats, so they're both considered renewable or biomass fuels. The standard biodiesel introduces the production of it, the refining of it, introduces oxygen into the fuel, and that causes issues for cold weather issues, separation during storing. It can create algae growth and slightly higher emissions than the new renewable diesel. So there's a number of problems as you go to a higher percentages of the biodiesel that we're used to that cause some operational issues with it as you go to higher percentages of it. The renewable diesel is refined in the same way as petroleum diesel. It's a process called hydrogenation. They use heat and pressure to refine it. Don't ask me to explain the details of that. I'm not an expert on it. But it does not introduce oxygen into the fuel, and so we get away from some of the issues that we have with the standard biodiesel with cold weather and such. It's essentially chemically almost identical to petroleum diesel, so it's very interchangeable with regular petroleum diesel. I mean, you can run it straight into diesel engines, even at 100% mixture, with no impacts to operating. So it's really good, really exciting stuff. We are not on the leading edge. It's pretty new in this part of the country. But it's being used pretty widely and has been for a couple of years now across the state of California. A couple of major cities in California, Oakland and San Francisco, have been running it completely in their fleet for some time now, city of Oakland since last fall. The United Parcel Service committed last year to buying 46 million gallons of the renewable diesel and are starting to run it in their fleet. Eugene Water and Electric Board in Oregon has been running it exclusively 100% for some time in their fleet. We're hearing rumors. We're on a webinar last week put on by Clean Cities that there's a rumor that there's legislation in the works in the state of Oregon to require it for all state agencies. There's a number of Northwest, other utilities in the Northwest that we communicate with regularly that are doing the same as us are transitioning to it as well. So the demand for this is really rapidly growing across the Northwest.
Rick, what are the drawbacks? I know has a number of them.
Yeah.
I mean, other than the oxygen issue as an improvement, what are the drawbacks?
I have two slides away. I'll talk to you about the downrest. I'd be happy to answer that now, but I am going to get to that. Yeah.
What's the downside? I see it.
Yeah. So I'll get to that if we could hold that thought.
Yep.
So benefits of the R99 immediately, almost 2 years ahead of time, puts us not only in compliance with the state law that's coming at us in 2018, but actually would put us actually beyond the requirement. We would get better cold weather weather performance and better operating performance compared to the biodiesel that we've been using. We'll get a very large immediate reduction in our emissions, carbon emissions, from our diesel fleet, which makes up about half of our entire fleet is our diesel fuel. So when we're talking about replacing our diesel fuel with this, that's about half of our total fuel consumption, so it's pretty significant. This would reduce our emissions by about two-thirds from our diesel fleet. So to put that in, to quantify that for you, in, last year we used about 113,000 gallons of diesel fuel in our fleet. That would have produced about 3.3 million pounds of carbon emissions, and a switch over to the R99 would immediately drop that to about a million pounds of carbon emissions. So about a $2.3 million estimated reduction in our carbon emissions in Chelan County virtually overnight by switching to the R99 diesel.
I got a question. You know,
yes, sir.
When we start talking about carbon reductions and those kinds of things, and we're ahead of schedule, ahead of the rule by a couple of years, it just comes to my mind, we get credit for that, or is it just something we're doing? And
we don't really get credit for that, no. Not in any tangible way. Right. Obviously, we're benefiting our local environment, but
when we talk about other things like water that we spill across the dam and other things like that, why don't we get credit for that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have a good answer.
Okay.
But we currently don't.
Okay.
Yeah. We would require no modifications to any of our equipment or our fueling facilities. It goes in. We can mix this straight in with our existing diesel fuel at any percentage or dump it straight in 100%, doesn't require any alterations to any of our equipment. So it's very easy and simple and cheap to make the switch. Yes, it is, and I'll touch on that. So downside, nothing's perfect, particularly in this area, it seems. But there are some drawbacks to this. Number one right now is the supply. This almost all of it is made in Indonesia, Singapore, that part of the world, mostly from palm oil. There's very little yet being produced in the United States. We heard last week that there now are three producers in the United States, one in California and two in Louisiana, but they're still pretty small scale. It'll be a long, long time till. Well, I hope not a real long time, but it's difficult to predict. But the point is there's very little being made in the United States yet. So supply is a bit of a concern. The good news is if we have any trouble getting supply, we would not skip a beat. We just would go back to what we're doing now, which is regular petrodiesel and some biodiesel mix. Or we could mix this in a smaller percentage. Instead of running at 100%, we could mix it at 20% with the petrodiesel. So there's great flexibility in that. If we run into any trouble getting supply, we just go back to our normal diesel fuel. The second biggest drawback right now is cost. It's a little more expensive. within areas where there's a really well-developed distribution and importing of it, and like in California, it's the cost is very comparable to this regular diesel or biodiesel. But right now for us, the closest port where it's being imported is Portland, so we've got a pretty significant additional cost to get it transported here. And we've been seeing that in the 20 to 55 cent per gallon range. Actually got an updated price this morning, and we hit about 60 cents this morning, the highest I've seen. So it's running a little bit more for us. We're hoping that in the longer term, as we get more domestic production, and we're hoping that it'll start being imported into Seattle before long, that those transportation costs are going to come down. And it's about 25 cents a gallon more than 100% standard biodiesel right now. So just for perspective, that's how much more it's costing.
How much was
so
that?
If we,
what was that number you said?
The range we've seen is 20 to 55 cents a gallon, now about 20 to 60 cents a gallon.
But didn't you have a percentage number just now, the higher than biodiesel?
About 25 cents a gallon more than 100% biodiesel. Yeah, so. The other number was compared to petrodiesel, the 20 to 60 cents per gallon increase. So if we run it straight 100% over a year's time, that would be about a $20,000 to $60,000 increase in our fuel costs, which is about 1 to 1.5% of our total O&M budget. So it's pretty minor, but it is a little more expensive. And so that definitely at this point is the downside.
Craig?
Yes.
Is there a mile per gallon difference?
Not significant. I think the jury's out on that. I think we could expect maybe a slightly better. It burns more efficiently, so you get a little more power out of it. It burns more efficiently, so I think we could expect a little increase. But at this point, I couldn't quote a number or really quantify that for you. It could be some minor offset on that.
Yeah, that was going to be one.
It has a higher, they call it cetane rating. It's higher, considerably higher than biodiesel. So it is more efficient burning, and you would expect probably a little higher mileage out of that, but there's not enough information, at least that I've seen, where I could say, yeah, we're going to definitively get a 10% increase or something. So.
My question too. Performance issues. No corrosiveness issues.
Does not appear to be.
There is with
it's
biodiesel,
very very
right?
clean.
Biodiesel.
This stuff looks like vegetable oil. It's extremely clean.
I think that corrosion is more with ethanol than biodiesel.
It is
isn't
ethanol.
It?
Yeah, much more with ethanol.
And that's different than biodiesel.
Yeah.
That's true. And then just one other thing, full disclosure, because most of this is produced in Indonesia, that part of the world, from a global environmental standpoint, there are concerns raised by some about deforestation of rainforest, because that's happening to some degree to plant palm oil to produce more of this, because the demand for this is really growing. So from a global standpoint, that is a concern by some, and I will tell you that, you know, that some would say that this is not a good idea because of that. We're hoping that increasing domestic production, will temper that, and there's a lot of scientists and others working on ways to produce this and other similar products without those impacts. But that's an issue that's out there, and just want to make sure you're aware of that. I think for us in the short term, this is the right thing to do for us, and that, you know, that's so we're planning to move in that direction. I don't know that this is the best long-term solution for us for alternative fuel. The alternative fuel industry is evolving and changing a lot, so I can't tell you that this is really the best solution for us long term, but I think all things considered right now, it seems to be so.
Yes. A quick question. Do you remember what the stated objective was of the law? Was it to reduce our dependency on foreign oil? Was it to reduce emissions? Was it to promote the use of agricultural products in the U.S.?
I don't remember the exact stated goal. I believe the biggest driver is emissions reductions.
Okay. Yeah. And the biodiesel itself results in higher emissions than?
Slightly higher, much better than petrodiesel. Biodiesel is considerably less, produces considerably less emissions than petrodiesel. This is slightly better than biodiesel.
Quick question, Craig, you know, as fleet manager, how, in your opinion, how much higher cost would you be willing to pay? I mean, since we're meeting our, you know, we're meeting the standards right now, how much higher would you go?
That's a great question. I don't have an exact number, but we've talked about this within the staff, is, you know, if the price keeps going up on it, you know, what do we do? So a couple things. Well, one thing we would do is probably reduce, instead of running it at 100% straight, we could mix it back down to like a 20% mix with the petrodiesel, and that would drop the price considerably for us. We would lose a lot of the benefit of the reduced emissions if we did that, but that would get the cost much more competitive. When we get to June 1st, 2018, then, you know, a lot could change in that time in this arena. So it's hard to predict for sure. But at that point, we would have to run at least a 20% mix of biodiesel of some kind, whether it's this or something else. So we'd have to run at least 20%.
Yeah, just kind of watching it. And
so
if I were betting on this, I would bet the price goes up, not down.
I think it's going to go down, but I can't guarantee that. I can't.
Yeah.
So we will be watching it. We watch the price every single week. We get reports of the price of all the fuels. If it goes up, you know, much more, we could blend it down, reduce the percentage, still get some benefit, environmental benefit, but keep the cost manageable. And then we'll have to wait and see June 1st, magic date, 2018, where everything is and what alternatives and what the prices are. But so we'll make those decisions as we go along. But that's probably the first thing we do is just mix it with a lower, with some standard diesel to bring the price in line. Just a couple last points to let you know what we've done to sort of mitigate risk of making this change. And the first thing is we've been running for some time now the renewable diesel with a controlled group of our fleet. So we fuel out of a fuel truck that we fuel the line department trucks and a bunch of the equipment at Holly Street. We go out and fuel those every night to keep them full. So we've been buying this renewable diesel for a few months now and running it just in equipment that we fuel ourselves, so we're not exposing the city and the fire department and the others, so we could do a controlled test. And we've now run about 20,000 gallons of this through our equipment over the last few months, have had zero issues. We purchased another 10,000 gallons that we're going to continue that trial. So a few more weeks of this. And when we're done with that, assuming everything is as we expect and no issues still, then we're going to transition to running it into our tank. So everyone will be running off of it at that point. We have communicated with the city of Wenatchee and fire districts 1 and 3 that use our pumps, gotten them on board to this, and they're okay with the switch. And then someone asked about Coleman oil. Was it Mr. Bowles? We will be able to add this to our fuel contract with Coleman oil. And so far, Coleman has been able to get this for us, and they think they have a reliable supply of it. And we'll be able to get it on our contract with the same markup we pay on all of our other fuels. Our plan now is to go ahead and run our last 10,000 gallons through our controlled trial, and then probably maybe about mid-September or so we'll be done with that, and we would start a switch over to running it in all of our fuel facilities. Any other questions?
We haven't done any controlled study during January.
No. What we will do, that's a great question, Commissioner Bowles. This product has far better cold weather performance than the old biodiesel, but we will, during the winter months, be mixing it with some percentage, probably 20% of number one diesel to make sure that we have no issues down to 30 degrees below zero or so. So we will take those precautions in the winter months. It is far superior to the old biodiesel, but we're going to play it safe on that and not take any chances. So. Yeah, we'll stay ahead of that.
Heated fuel lines.
Yeah. I learned a lot.
I was thinking of learning a lot. You know, with the old biodiesels, when they first got going, one of the side benefits of the biodiesel was when you went drove behind that car, it smelled like French fries. and I wonder, will our rigs smell like coconuts now?
I don't think they'll smell like coconuts, but it's interesting out here in our tight facilities where our line trucks are all parked, we've heard comments from the linemen out there and stuff that they don't smell the diesel fumes anymore. Mm-hmm. So that's a great thing for our employees. Much cleaner.
Super. Yeah. Any questions from anybody in the audience? Great presentation. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You got time for one?
Yeah, you want to bring one of the commissioner items, and I could probably go through the items from the last meeting as well, to make sure you're all aware of those.
But no manager items that you have time for at this point?
No, we do. Yeah, we have one that we can bring up.
Okay.
John Stoll's going to talk about the Chelan substation.
Okay. And that might be all we have time for. We'll see. Depends on how long we want to question him.
We'll move through it pretty quick. I think you've seen this before, but just the setup. August will be a pretty active month, primarily with the North Shore Chelan substation. By the way, John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities, and with me is Tika Sellers. The timeline, again, we've been pretty active, starting in May with various community meetings. And updates since the last meeting, staff has been busy contacting property owners in the three general areas that were recommended by the substation topic team. Those are the areas that we'll briefly go over on the map. And since then, our lands and engineering group has been talking to some of those property owners about the potential of, further evaluation with their site. So that leads us into August. So today here, just to give a quick update on our process. Next week on August 9th, the City Council of Chelan asked to be kept in the loop as we move forward. So I will give them a very similar type update that as we look forward to that community meeting on August 24th, everyone's in the know and everyone's had an opportunity to weigh in. But that one, we'll probably be pretty active because we do, we'll present some sites. So we've gone from areas down to sites. So the point of that is to look at the attributes, hear any concerns customers might have, get that feedback, but ultimately take that input and then go to the next step where we're talking about engaging a engineering firm to do some further site evaluation, some financial look at that, how the routes potentially could move away from that substation, some renderings of what it might look like, because ultimately we are driving towards a presentation to the board later this year to recommend an alternative or alternatives to choose from. I'm going to turn this over to Tika. She's been very active in communicating with a lot of customers, and her, as well as the communications group, had put this postcard flyer out today, I believe.
Yeah, we wanted to wait until we came forward to you, Commissioner. So this will go out this afternoon to about 6,500 customers in the Chelan, Manson, and Chelan Falls area. So we put a little bit more detail in this postcard than we typically do because I'd heard some feedback over the last couple of months, people coming and saying, I never heard anything about this. And as you know, we've been going forward to the community for over a year. So they say, well, I just don't pay attention to those things because they don't seem like they impact me. So we added a little bit more detail in here, and then we've also got all of our information on our website, so we've been trying to direct folks there. So this is the postcard that will go out today, and looking forward to that meeting on the 24th. It'll be a pretty big meeting. I do have one update. I don't know if John wants me to add it now, or maybe when we look at the map, I'll mention it.
I'd like to just further say Tika's been very busy with this project. She answers a lot of emails and a lot of phone calls, so she's been doing a really nice job, her and the rest of the folks that have been working through this. So just quickly on the process, you know, this really where we're at, that green box, the discovery of parcels within the areas, we're moving out of that into more of the specific parcel evaluation. And again, based on the further input and feedback, we'll take that into the feasibility and engineering. And we do have just a quick reminder of what those areas are. Tika's up there with some core board that has it laid out. So what we will be looking at are the areas that are in the red circles. I know it's probably a little bit difficult to see.
On our website, we actually put an interactive map on there now. And so people can go on and zoom in, zoom out. They can change the land base or the base map. Cool. It's actually really cool. We have that on the website. But, so we have Area 14. We were originally looking here in Area 13, but didn't have any property owners that were interested. So we did have some property owners that contacted us up here and felt like this area met a lot of the same objectives. It's farther away from the load center, but underneath transmission and kind of out of sight, out of mind. So it would kind of demonstrate the same thing that we're good about looking in this area.
Excuse me, what is that?
So this is right where the transmission lines come together. So this is Winesap, Cooley, Templin Road.
Can you point to Winesap going up the hill?
Yep, this is Winesap here. And this is Cooley Road here. I know, sorry. Such a large area.
That was our first one.
Yeah. No problem. So then in Area 9-10, we've got one site here that we want to present on the 24th, one site in this area that we want to present. Unfortunately, in Area 7, we're having a hard time. We may need to move on from that. Our team is going to meet later this week and discuss what our next steps will be there. The one property owner in this area that was willing to sell, he kind of actually was in this area. His property just is not going to work out for a few different reasons. And then the other majority property owner in that area is not willing to, is not interested in having a conversation with us. And so we're just going to move on from that. So we may only be presenting two sites at the community meeting. Our team's going to discuss a strategy there.
Well, we're right at noon, but we certainly would entertain any questions you may have.
On the map, there was a large number of the blue circles, and those were the other areas that we looked at that are no longer under consideration. So I think it's significant to look at how many areas you have narrowed it down from.
And we want to be careful, Commissioner Smith, just to make sure that we don't say that they're not under consideration any longer. In the site evaluation matrix where we actually went through and scored all of those, we started with the highest. So, you know, for example, because we can't find anything in Area 7, we may go back and look at some of those kind of mid-range areas again. So they would kind of put them in a parking lot, I guess, if you will.
Okay.
So.
Good enough.
Actually, I have a comment. You're walking a tight line with respect to property. And property values. And while it is our effort to sincerely be transparent, we also know that property prices suddenly go up when people find out it's the PUD is looking to buy it. So I'm pleased to hear you say we have parking lot that would be a backup should the site location cost be more than a reasonable price. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Appreciate your comments.
Any additional questions?
Yeah, and following up with Commissioner Arsenal, you know, this is an extensive process, and it does affect property values, for a lot of people. And the PUD, the potential, increased cost because of this process. It's open and transparent. So the kind of what I'm looking at, are we actually looking out a little farther as well? Not only in looking at one site, but maybe looking at two sites, and essentially killing you know, a bird with two, you know, two birds with one stone, and go out and look a little farther ahead, because this is a process. You've had the community engage, and if we know or can anticipate where that growth would be, would that not be prudent to look a little farther ahead and say, okay, this is where it's going to be? And then that helps the development of the area as well, because people know where the next substation would be going into the future.
Well, our primary objective right now is to select the one site.
But
you do bring up really good points, and, you know, optimistically, if we would find an extra site that out of this process, that certainly would be helpful. But then, you know, you would introduce trying to probably balance out a future unknown where the load would be.
Speculating.
Yeah. But certainly that's a perspective to keep in mind.
Just before we leave you today, I did want to point out this interactive map on the Chelan substation website. So if you're interested, you can come here, and it works just like a Google map. Peter Dower set this up for us. You can change the base map here if that's easier for you to see. I see some of you looking at the map in your presentation, and it just is too small. So if you're interested, you can come to the website and use this interactive map that might be a little bit more helpful to you. So.
What's the link, Tika?
So actually, if you just do chelanpud.org/new-chelan-substation, that'll take you right there. Yep. But it's under Learning Center and in your neighborhood. That's where most all of our capital projects information is located. So.
All right.
And that's on our external website.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions from anybody? I think we're at a perfect breaking point, so why don't we recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock?
We haven't looking back, looking forward. We haven't done anything. This is a bit worth that.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody to the August 1, 2016 regular commission meeting. We met this morning for a study session, had a good, full, productive session, and I'd like to welcome people back to the afternoon session. All the commissioners are here. Greg Carrington is sitting in for Steve Wright, and all of the regular staff are here. I'd like to remind people that if there's any item on the agenda this afternoon that you want to speak to, we ask that you come up to the table here where the microphone is and state your name and address clearly for the record, so we have a record of this as this is being recorded. And since it is being recorded, I'd also request that people silence their cell phones at this time so we don't have that interruption during the meeting. At this time, commissioners, we have a consent agenda. What is the desire of the commission?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as presented. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. And now we move on to the regular agenda, and item number 10 is a resolution that will be introduced by Greg Carrington.
So item 10 is a resolution authorizing amendment number 3 to services agreement with Eureka Engineering of Silver Lake, Washington for Crane Consulting, and Brett Bickford's going to present that to us.
Good afternoon, Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. The business that I have this afternoon is a resolution authorizing an amendment to the service agreement with Eureka, and I'm going to provide a short presentation that gives a little background on the crane program that we have underway and how Eureka helps us with that effort. In 2012, the Engineering Services Department with hydro operations collaborated to do an assessment program of all the hydro cranes, and so we went through and did a, what we call level 1 and level 2 inspection of those cranes. What that identified was there are a number of repairs and replacements that needed to be performed to make sure that these cranes were fully operational, safe, and were very reliable. What we identified in that was that we would need to be putting together plans and specifications to go out for competitive bidding to do work on about 8 of our cranes at the hydros. That program started in 2013, and the first cranes that we started working on were at Rocky Reach, and you've heard some of those presentations, and you've seen some of those resolutions where we've awarded bids to contractors to work on the intake gantry crane at Rocky Reach, as well as the bridge cranes. To help us with that work, we hired Eureka Engineering. We established a service agreement with them that has task authorizations. Those are releases to do specific work. And we established a contract under Resolution 13-13837 for about $650,000. And that had a scope of work that got us through the Rocky Reach cranes, did some urgent maintenance at Rock Island, and lasted until 2017. As we look ahead, we're contemplating the work that's going on at Rock Island Powerhouse 1 with the advancement of the B1 to B4 and 5 through 8 units. And then we know we've got Powerhouse 2 rehab coming up. And so in anticipation of all that extra work, what we are have done is we've planned and we've built business cases for the rest of the crane rehabilitation work that will extend through 2020. And so in doing that planning, we've identified that because Eureka has been doing an excellent job for us, we would like to extend the contract with them, the time frame through 2020, as well as increase the dollar value that we could contract with them for. So it's not a guarantee to them. Again, it just it's for internal budgeting purposes. So if this resolution is approved for this dollar amount, then we will use that in our budgets going forward and our business plans. And it also helps us to schedule for our labor. We made a conscious effort on this project to not try to staff it with 100% of district staff because it is so specialized. We don't have that expertise, and it's hard to hire people when these crane projects are kind of one every 40, 50 years. It didn't make sense to hire experts and keep them on staff full time. And so the contractors that we use on this with Eureka actually have lead designers for some of the large major crane projects that have gone into retirement, and then we utilize their expertise to help us from start to finish on these. The current contract had 10 task authorizations, and again, it was focused on a lot of the urgent work and included the large intake gantry crane at Rocky Reach and the bridge cranes. So with this additional $850,000, we're going to amend two task authorizations. One is for the Rocky Reach intake gantry crane. And as if you recall, we bid that with the option of refurbishing that crane or building a new one. And so we selected the option to build new. And so with that, we're building a whole new steel structure to support that hoisting equipment. And so we would like to continue to use these folks as they will inspect that at the factory that's where it's being fabricated now in Canada, and then continue when the work comes on site. As that's erected and assembled, we want to use them for that as well. At Powerhouse, at Rock Island Powerhouse, at the spillway, we're working on an intake gantry crane, and internally we lost electrical engineers, so we want to utilize this company to come on site for us and help us finish that repair work up. And finally, and for most of the $850,000, that's going to be work on this crane. This is the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 bridge crane. This crane is used on a daily basis to move small items in and out of the plant, but it's a real workhorse when it comes time for disassembly. And so this crane has all original controls and equipment, and we need to upgrade that as we go into the Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation work.
You say original controls back into the 30s?
Well, this one is in Powerhouse 2, so it's going to be your 78, okay. 79 time frame. Yeah. It's got all analog equipment. And it works in tandem with this intake gantry crane. And so both of these cranes we're proposing, and we've done business cases, just finished them this summer, and these will be projects that will be in the annual budget to do major controls upgrades. Again, they're both original. Right now, they actually are designed to work in tandem together to make up to a 471-ton pick to remove the stator and generator out of the bulb units. But right now, these two cranes don't work in tandem any longer. So that's one of the things that we want to do is redesign the controls package so these will work together again and then update them with more modern equipment.
Just curious, why don't they work in tandem anymore?
They have done a lot of work over about the last 10 years to try to get them to work, and for whatever reason, they're not able to. So we're going to replace the control system.
But they originally did.
They originally did.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So may I ask one more? So you said
There have been 10 task authorizations.
Yes.
Which I love hearing about that. I like the way you work those task authorizations. But what would be an example of one task authorization?
Sure.
I'm just curious.
Sure. So I'll take task authorization number two. So that was where we wrote an agreement with Eureka to help us assemble the bid documents for that crane. And so we used their expertise to write some of the technical specs on what type of controls are required, what type of gears and bearings and other parts that we want to assemble and how they should work together as a package. And they're really good on writing the testing and commissioning, so where we can go through and make sure these things are operating properly and not going to prematurely wear. So we do a lot of bluing of how the gear teeth mesh and things like that to make sure that we're going to get long life.
So we tell them what we need.
Uh-huh.
And then they put it together, and then it comes back to you.
The technical specs, yep.
The technical specs, and then you look them over.
Yep, we review them.
Basically, check them off.
And then we assemble them into the complete bid package, which then our procurement department uses for competitive bidding. Okay. And then we go on and have them help us with the submittals. So often we give a performance spec. How fast should it hoist? How fast should the trolley move? How fast should the gantry move? And so then when contractors supply submittals, they help us review those to make sure that we're going to get the product that's required by the bid document. And then we're going to have them go on and help us do inspections in the shops and in the field.
Thank you. That's helpful. Yeah.
So that was the second crane. And then the third crane is an original. 1930 is when we saw this crane come into work at Rock Island Powerhouse 1. And so this crane has actually seen a lot of damage and overloading a couple times through its life. We can't get any spare parts for it now, so we're custom making components. And it's at the end of its life, and so we're proposing that we would replace this crane. So that $850,000 helps finish work we've got on two existing contracts, and then it will help us with future contracts on these three cranes as well.
Questions.
So that comes in small parts and not, well, large parts, and is assembled right on
correct
premises.
Yep, they're all assembled on.
That's huge.
Yeah. You know, this the cranes are a subject that probably don't get people really excited a whole lot, and we don't talk about them a lot. How many cranes do we have on our dams? If you don't know that, we can get the number later.
Not the exact number, but all together, including, you know, we have quite a few little small ones. We call them jibs.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably over 20 cranes at the three hydros.
Pretty amazing when you think about it.
Stationary that are not mobile, you know, on tires that can drive around, right?
Yeah. And we note, I am noting that you believe in just-in-time delivery of the three pictures were taken this morning.
Yeah. Sorry, I was out fishing on Thursday and Friday, so. Suzanne was very kind to help get this together, and so I plopped in a few extras today.
What's this?
So on the very front slide, this is some work that we've done in the past. And so below where you see the large yellow things, I think that's what you were asking about. So those are water bags that are used to load test. So if we get a crane that's rated for 300 tons, then we want to test it to 300 plus so that we can make sure that it's safe to operate and all the equipment functions as desired. So those are filled with water, and they're rigged up on a beam. We hook them up to the crane and make sure that the crane can function with that load.
Yeah. Interesting. They look like some of the water bags that the helicopters are dropping on the fires.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah.
Commissioner Arsenault.
Brad, I think you've already answered this question, but for the benefit of those in the audience that might be listening to our recorded message, the first contract that we signed, which was a task agreement, was for 5 years, cost
$650,000.
Uh-huh. So the update for the second contract will be for only 2 years, $850,000. So there's an assumption that the additional amount of work that needs to be done justifies the $850,000. And that's the difference from the $650,000 where we had a 5-year contract. Am I tracking correctly?
Yes. So the term of the agreement that we wrote originally was 13 through 17.
Right.
And we knew that, well, at the time, it was the plan to get us through the Rocky Reach work. Internally, staffing-wise, what I was hoping was that we would gain enough experience internally that our staff would actually take over and continue doing these Rock Island cranes through about 2020. Internally, because of all the additional work we've seen with our turbine generator work, we've decided that that's where we want to focus staff, and we've asked for additional personnel, and we're going to staff those projects because we see that by them designing, constructing, and turning over those, that that gives them the experience so then we can do that maintenance with them. On these projects, the crane technology has changed immensely since when these were originally designed, and so we need those experts. We don't have them. And then once we're done with this, it's just the maintenance. So we do have a mechanical and electrical that are assigned to this to learn and glean and be involved so that they can help operations maintain them as we go forward. But we're not trying to retain the crane designer expertise.
Perfect. So there's more personnel being utilized from Eureka in this case.
Correct.
Got yep.
Thank more, you. More man hours.
Thank you.
Super. Any other questions? Well, commissioners, we have resolution number 10 before us. What's the wish of the commission?
I'll move approval, Mr. Chairman, of resolution number 10 as described.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution 10 as presented. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And that is all our resolutions for today. Manager items.
So we have one special announcement by Jeff Smith.
Terry, come on up. Terry didn't know this was going to happen. He's probably wondering.
Yeah.
Sorry about no heads up, Terry. Wondering why he's been summoned to the boardroom before the commission. Well, Terry, you haven't been in the front table, so you introduce yourself first of all. Jeff Smith, Managing Director, District Services.
I'm Terry McFadden. I'm a Material Specialist Foreman for Wenatchee, Leavenworth, and Chelan.
So on August 2nd, 1976, I was recently graduated from Huskyville and working in downtown Seattle. And on that same day, this guy began a 40-year career with Chelan PUD. He was 12 at the time. Terry grew up in Chelan and reportedly recognized early on that he wanted to work for Chelan PUD. He started as a meter reader and worked his way through the accounting department, eventually landing in the warehouse group where today, as he mentioned, he serves as materials specialist foreman extraordinaire. In terms of longevity, Terry is currently ninth on the list of all-time tenured employees. Just coincidentally, Russ Schaefer, retired in 1972, holds the current record at just over 43 years. Are you going to go for that?
Well, there's chatter on the street about that.
Okay.
And I'm a senior at Central Washington University at the moment, and with the help of the PUD and that program. And so I've got probably another 2 years to get that 17 credits that I've got yet to finish. So I'm looking forward to that. My wife.
Would you like to introduce her?
She's been a big help for me because what I found out after going back to school after 41 years is men really do write how they think, not think how they write. and my wife's very good at all that kind of stuff, so she critiques everything that I do. I probably get sent back to the back room 5 or 6 times before I get to submit that report. He'll mark it up just like an old teacher, just like that. And about, with a little bit of help, we're doing about a 3.75 since I went back. And anyway, that's that. I really love working for the PUD. And I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Well, we couldn't imagine that either. I mean, this guy is the epitome of the legacy of Chelan PUD employees. He's selfless, honest. He has an extraordinary work ethic. He's caring, compassionate, motivated to provide what they do best in materials, and that's provide customer service, the best possible for the clients who are the operating units here at the district. His supervisor is Materials Superintendent Randall Phillips, and Randall is going to come up, has a few thoughts to offer as well. Randall?
Yeah, he's a good-looking kid, wasn't he?
I think we're about the same finish. I cycled through all those. It's just great.
Yeah. Ooh, I had more hair.
Mustache.
You can imagine after 40 years, there's some stories to be told. So I picked one, and I hope it's okay with you, Terry. And what I know about the story, Terry, you can fill in the gaps, because I wasn't there. So this is what I know. So this is a story about a gentleman named Tom Oakley. So I don't know if that rings a bell to anybody here other than Terry. The history is that Tom came up the ranks in the warehouse, and then my position, materials superintendent, came about. So Tom came out of the union and went in as manager. And so at that point, I believe that Terry moved up to foreman. I got it right so far?
No.
Okay.
So Tom Oakley worked in the warehouse with me. So there came a time where he became the superintendent, like Randall was. There also came a time where the district decided that they didn't want to have a superintendent for a while, but they did want a foreman. And I was senior at the time. So, as you know, management in general is at will. So they didn't have another place for him at the time. And because he's my friend, I went to the union and said I would step down if he'd become foreman. So they did that, and I did that in writing that when he left, I would be the foreman. So he got to stay on at the PUD, and he did that for 6 years as foreman. And then I got to be foreman.
So Tom was going to lose his job, no longer have a position in the district. Terry, in his own regard, went to the union for the plan. They couldn't figure out any other plan. Terry figured it out. But the union has said, here's my plan. I'll step down, give him a spot. All I ask is that when the foreman spot comes open again, that I have the opportunity that I get. So that's selflessness. Mm-hmm. So, John, Terry, just appreciate your 40 years here.
This is the 40-year pin for Terry. You don't see these very often, so you might want to pass it around where they can see what it is, Terry. But I just wanted to say thank you for all that you do.
Yeah, thank you.
Terry's my right-hand man. You know, I know how Tom felt.
Got it right here.
Because Terry and I worked together for 10 years also, and it's funny how you end up in a position where I start the sentence, he finishes it. If there's something that goes wrong, he's on it. I arrive, I'll help, or he'll look at me and I'll take care of it. Or well, sometimes we just look at each other, and then he'll go one direction, I'll go the other direction. So it's amazing, and I know that's the relationship you have with Tom, because you spent 10 years with him.
Yeah.
So
sure.
I appreciate working with you.
Yeah, this whole thing is pretty humbling.
Anyway, you earned it.
Appreciate your dedication. Yeah. And 3.5 more years, huh?
Well, yeah, we'll see. You know.
The hair.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah,
mine was a handlebar.
Of course.
Joyce was so happy when I got rid of it.
We think, Carmen, we think you should shave your mustache again.
Well, I did it once, but I showed my wife when I was in Pasco, and I could hear her scream.
All right.
Teasing you. I know. I saw it without it.
It was awful. So.
Okay. I think we have one more manager item.
Oh, we have several, I think. Don't we?
And we have one that I have. Oh, good. Down. Unless you know of others.
I'm so confused from moving things around.
So I understand that we have representatives from Localtel here that we're going to talk about a transition that's going to be happening in a short while. So I don't know.
I think it might be helpful.
Pull in another chair.
Okay. I'll just open it up.
Okay.
I have some handouts.
Thank you.
While he's passing those out, I'm Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. It was just barely a year ago when we were here in the boardroom and we were consummating the sale of the video heading into Localtel. And we did that for a lot of good reasons, that it was a better fit in Localtel, and it also gave them the opportunity to make some changes to the head end that would benefit them, benefit their customers and our customers. And to that end, Dimitri's here today to talk about this evolution of the video services that we transport on our network and some of the changes that they're getting ready to make and the impact of those changes to both their customers and our customers. With that, I'll let Dimitri.
Thank you, Mike. My name is Dimitri Mandelis. I work for Localtel. I'm the president, and our address is 341 Grant Road. I've given you all of a packet of information that we're sending out to customers soon. First, it was about a year ago when we acquired the PUD head end and with the plan on improving it and moving it to our building. It's been about a year, and in that year we've been busily working and purchasing equipment to accomplish that. In the year, in the last year, we've added on the Schlan PUD network about 16 HD channels. We've used up about all the frequencies that the network will allow in its current state. The network has two pieces to it. There's an analog piece, which is like channels 2 through about 100, and then there's digital, the HD ones that are in the 500s and stuff. What we're going to be doing is we've been preparing to go to an all-digital lineup. That accomplishes a bunch of things. The first one is it gets us a lot more frequencies back, so we can add more HD channels. For every analog channel that's out there, we can add 2.5 HD channels. Oh, wow. it also allows us to be able to move the head end easier to our location on Yakima Street and move it out of here so we can take the satellite dishes off the roof. So we've been working on this. And we think we're ready. So what we did was we are going to notify the 6,000, 7,000 customers that are on TV about what's coming up. And we're going to do it in many ways in the notification. So you see kind of the outreach that we're going to do. The first thing is we're going to start some mailings out, I think, in the next day or two. We're also doing robocalls. This is where you've probably gotten one before, where a computer calls and tells you something. We're going to, for us to test out, and this is at the PUD's request, and I think it's a very good request, they would like us to test out the all-digital lineup before we roll it out. And even though theoretically it should work, we'd like to know if there's issues. So Thursday, this coming Thursday, from 2 to 4 in the morning, and we'll be robo-calling this. Every customer in Chelan County who has TV will get a call. From 2 to 4 o'clock on Thursday morning, we will take the network down, the TV piece down. And this will allow us to test out the digital piece. And the way that works is we have the new lineup already working at the CTC building, and we have the old lineup that everybody's using. On the new lineup, we'll just take the cable out of that, plug it into the equipment that sends the signal out to the rest of the plant, and we're going to go to Malaga, Manson, Leavenworth, Chelan. We're going to test out for 2 hours those signals. The people's TVs won't work, but we'll be able to tell if there's a good likelihood of chance that we have any issues or what kind of issues that we're going to have. So this is on Thursday. Assuming that test goes well, on the 22nd at noon or midnight, we will move the cable over. And that's when the fun begins, because there's 6,000 to 7,000 customers. In fact, every customer is affected. And they're affected in different ways. We've called all the hotels, motels, places that have, you know, 50 TV sets, and kind of gone through what kind of TV sets they have and started planning that conversion from analog to digital for them. And I don't want to get real technical, but I thought I would just give you an idea. There's really four options for customers, so you understand this if you get questions on it. If the customer has an option one, a set-top box with us and no DVR on it, then they don't really have to do anything different. The channels will show up with the new channel numbers, and they just need to know, where do you go now for the Food Network? Where do you go now for ESPN? And so we've included in your sheet there, you'll see an old alphabetical old number to an alphabetical new number. So, for example, A&E 526 moved to channel 44. Okay. There's also one, if you just only know the number of your network, like I always went to channel 6. Well, channel 6 is still on channel 6. But channel 31 is now, Pac-12, Washington is now on channel 34. So these old lineups to new lineups will be everywhere. They're on our website. They're going to mail to them.
They're on the website.
There'll be PDF to them. If you go to localtel.tv, you'll see this.
Okay.
So we've got a little bit of experience over the last year, you know, in fact, over the last 10 years of doing TV, that channel number changes are pretty drastic for people, especially older people. Might scratch that. We've geared ourselves up to not do any new installs that week, to have everybody on staff, to be in all these areas. So if you have a DVR, you have a set-top box, but no DVR, there's nothing for you to do except figure out where your new channels are. Okay? If you have a set-top box and you have a DVR, there again, all the channels will show up, but all your recordings, the new recordings you want to do, will have to be reprogrammed. All the old programs that you have recorded would still be there. But the new recordings, like if you were recording the Food Network, which was on channel 30, you're going to change that to channel 76. Okay. Okay. If you don't have a set-top box of any kind, and all you have is what you have is the digital TV set, and you don't use a set-top box, all you'll have to do is, if it's a digital TV set, is rescan your, you know, so you go into the TV set. This will help people with this. But there's a spot in there to say rescan. It looks for all the channels. And we've done something I thought very ingenious. We've set up all the digital frequencies to match the cable lineup for the first 134 channels. So channel 31 on the set-top box is channel 31 on your TV without the set-top box. Which is, if you... For those of you who don't use a set-top box, it's a really big thing. Well, how do I find my channel? For example, channel Spike TV will be on channel 49. I'm sure that's a big one for all you guys. But it's the same one on the DVD, same one on the set-top box. It's also the same channel there. Not that it matters to you, but we're also changing the Douglas County TV lineup at the same time, and it will match this lineup. So it'll be one lineup to rule them all. Okay. So The last group is the biggest group, not the biggest in quantity, but the biggest in worry, is the people who have old TV sets, SD TV sets. They're not digital, and they work today because we have an analog lineup. Okay. So what we've got is the analog TV will not work with our new lineup. So what we have is these little boxes from Cisco called DTAs. And you just plug in your analog TV into that, and you plug your coax into that, and you have the same lineup we have. There will be a cost to it, but it's a fairly low cost. It's $1.95 a month for that box, and with the first 3 months being free. So there will be no... But if somebody goes and switches out their analog for a digital one, then they don't need that box. For the hotels and motels who have... There's a few that have actually still analog sets. In fact, one of them, we tried to get them to go digital, and they told us they didn't want to. And I, you know, said, why not? Customers will like it. He says it's harder to steal an analog set because you're carrying out a big box, right? I never thought of that, but that's a good reason, I guess, to keep one. So we have contacted them, and we actually kind of believe we've worked out good relationships with all of them. The bars, the restaurants, the stuff that have our TVs, TV signals, we've contacted them too, so we can help them with a rescan of those things. And then the last group is the modulated group, where, like, if you're a hotel or motel and you have the normal lineup, but then you have an HBO or a Starz, something like that, what we've been doing is modulating them, getting it so it'll work on the analog lineup in their house. We can do that with the digital now for them, so that those customers still can get for their patrons, HBO, Starz, or whatever they want. It's a premium service, and it's encrypted. But this little box has the unencryption built into it, which was really kind of a very sweet thing. So that's what we're doing. We're very worried about it. We expect a lot of phone calls. If we don't do it, we have to do it. We're competing against companies that don't even have analog anymore, and very few people watch analog, and you can't even go buy an analog TV anymore. Everything's digital. So we really need to do this. We've worked hard. We have an incredible amount of money into this project, and it's one of three TV projects we're working on. We do have a multicast IP project, which I've been testing at home with the Schlein PD, and it is fabulous. It is just, I can't wait to roll that out and after this is done. And so that's all I had. If you have questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Major, what was the name of this little box you're talking about, if you have an analog TV?
Let's call it DTA. And I think that's short for
Digital Terminal Adapter.
Digital Terminal Adapter. It's made by Cisco, and it is 5 inches long. It says here in the box, it's 5 inches long, 1 inch high, and it's only required if you want to have an analog TV work, or if you don't want to use the digital tuner in your TV set, you actually want to use this one. There's no guide on it. You know, it doesn't tell you what's going to be playing, but it will let you go through the channels just like a set-top box, but without having the guide. It's for those few customers. We think that's a dying market, you know, really. So we bought about 1,000 of these boxes in the hopes that that'll be enough to cover. But I think the hotels and motels we figure are going to use about 350 to 400 of them. And then we're not really sure how many people have, you know, a TV out in the garage or a TV out in the, you know, in the old playroom, you know, and so they still want to use those. This is a way for us to say, just, you know, get this box, and as soon as you get a digital TV, just give us back the box and save yourself $1.95 a month. So, yeah.
I wish you a lot of luck on the 22nd.
Yeah.
I'll try to prepare our household.
This is the good news. This is the first successful. I assume we will be. We could start moving out of the building. We won't be using a single thing of the head end or the receivers or the dishes. It'll take us months to move out, and that, I know you would like us to move out. So, yeah.
I don't know. I kind of like the colo money.
Do you like the colo?
Add a little bit to what Dimitri said.
this is very, very complex. And it's complex because many of the people that are using the old analog TVs are quite set in their ways. And we discovered that last year with the secondary audio program issue that cropped up. It's also complex in the fact that some big changes are being made in the network. Dimitri referred to the fact that he's scheduling all of his resources around this the week of the 22nd. We also are going to schedule our resources to support him wherever we can during that week. The other thing that's really big here, and Dimitri hit upon this, this unifies the channel lineup between Douglas County and Chelan. And the reason that's big is there's a lot of movement across the river back and forth with people living on one side moving to the other. It makes it a little bit stickier when they have the same channel lineup available to them. As a guy that's moved a whole lot, what's one of the first things you get frustrated with? You get into your new house and none of the channels are where they used to be. So this is a good step forward for Localtel. It's also a good step forward for Chelan PUD. It raises the bar once again on the level of TV service that's going to be provided. And I, like Randy, wish you all the luck in the world.
Thank you. The day after the cut, we will be able to add another 15 channels.
Which immediately?
Immediately. So we'll have 15 more HD channels the day after the cut. Also, it does align the channel lineup with our mobile offerings that you have not seen yet. But your iPhones and iPads will soon have all the channels, too. And it aligns them with that. So if you know our lineup, you'll also know the lineup on your iPhone and iPad. Because the tuner is starting to turn into an app. And when it becomes an app, it's available everywhere and anywhere. And so.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the risk.
Well, my biggest worry one is the test we're doing Thursday.
Yeah.
Tell you the truth. The rest, it actually works great in the lab. We've been using it, and it looks wonderful. It's just, can we push digital to all ends of your network? And we believe we can. And I think the PED believes we can. We just want to know for sure. Right?
So you're not calling us between 2 and 4. That's what I...
Just you, Sheila.
Yeah.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Really, yeah. Our robocall starts at 2:05.
I know, right?
We really want to make sure you're aware of it. No. It'll be during the day, and most people won't even know because we'll take it down at 2, bring it up at 4. They won't even know we did anything.
I think I know a few people that might notice.
Yeah. Oh, are there some night owls up there?
Yeah.
Oh, coffee shop opens at 4 a.m.
Well, remember that.
That's fine. 2 to 4 is our window.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's all the manager items. Why don't we slide right to commission items?
Yeah. My grandson has my iPhone. That was probably a mistake. So this is from memory. So I had a number of emails and phone calls. I haven't attended any meetings per se, but I've had a lot of emails and phone calls and done a lot of work in that regard pertaining to BB Springs. I don't want to call it a project. It's the development down on the river, on the Columbia River, just north of the BB Springs BB Bridge.
Fish and Wildlife.
Fish and Wildlife, and it's funded by Fish and Wildlife, and... Anyway, they are interested in potentially getting some public power benefit monies, and they've been in contact with me and with Eric. And so I've had some phone calls regarding that and taken some people down there. And if you haven't been there, drop by sometime. If you're going north, pull in there and stop. It's beautiful. Lots of really neat trails, and there's great, if you like birds, there's great birding and wildlife and lots of kiosks and good. We're just completing the placards that are going to go up, and they should be really great, good educational pieces. So some work on that, water workshop planning. I'm on the water workshop planning committee group, and we've had some phone calls regarding that. Some NWPPA work regarding an upcoming distributed energy resources meeting, and then I'm a vice chair for the GRC Government Relations Committee, and I've been doing some work on that, and didn't meet with Steve this week. That was canceled, or no, actually, I couldn't meet. And I think that's all. And coming up, I don't have anything within the next 2 weeks other than this kind of thing. I don't have any planned meetings out of time, out of town.
Gary?
Looking back on my calendar, I'm reminded of a meeting I had, actually at a social event with Senator Parlett, in which we discussed in length and in some degree of depth over my head, Bitcoin versus blockchain technology. And Senator Parlett was kind enough to invite me to send her some information as it relates to J.P. Morgan and their tests that they're currently running on blockchain. Very interesting technology that we may see in our near future. I did attend the retiree luncheon.
I did too. Sorry to interrupt.
And that was a terrific event. It's a wonderful thing. I can't think of too many organizations that in today's world honor the retirees. So this is just a fabulous event. Glad to be involved. Also had an opportunity to meet with the Tri-Commission workshop in preparation for a meeting that is up and coming. We'll have an opportunity shortly to meet with Eric. And that's what I've done.
Okay. Dennis.
Okay. Naturally, just as I wanted to look at that, I fat fingered my screen and moved it completely away from where I wanted. Obviously, today's commission meeting, KPQ tomorrow, meeting with a former employee on Thursday who has some intentions of moving back to the Valley. That's kind of an exciting thing. And then, of course, our meeting later in the month, the board workshop with the NASH training toward the end. And met with, it's the 23rd? And met with Steve and with Eric this past week. And that's about it.
Okay, Carnan.
Okay, well, looking back, I did have the opportunity to meet with Eric and Steve last week, and also went to Energy Northwest, had 2 days there, going through meetings and getting briefed on some of the projects that they're looking at. In particular, one is the Enslow Dam with, up in Okanagan. They've got a project there where they're going to they want to refurbish that dam, have a new powerhouse and penstock, and I think it's about 9 megawatts of power that they would produce if it goes into place. So discussion around that is, you know, the level of risk is it, because it's a partnership between both Energy Northwest and Okanagan PUD, and so there's a lot of discussions around who assumes what risk, what level, that sort of thing, and the contract in general. We are also briefed on another project that Energy Northwest is involved with the city of Richland, which is a solar project and battery storage. Three things that will come from that is, you know, research. They'll learn how to operate it. There'll be training involved, and also the production and storage of electricity. Again, that's a project we're talking about. It hasn't been approved yet. They're trying to get grant money, $4 million, but it's kind of funny when they say it's matching money, because when you look at the project over a period of time, it $4 million turns into $12 million. Hmm. So I don't know if the grant it helps, but yeah, of course they're going to have to get their heads around the cost of it, and that's what's going to be the driver of the project one way or the other. Because the city of Richland certainly doesn't want to pay the full cost of that. It has to be competitive. They do get some credits for having renewable energy, so they're looking at those things. But it's something that we could all learn from if it does go into production. And so it's those are the things we're looking at, collaborating with the other utilities. Moving forward, let's see here. I did, no. I did attend the retiree luncheon as well, and I agree with Commissioner Arso. It's a really good event, and you know, and I think the people that attend that, the retirees love to go and talk about old times, and you can see they've really bonded over the years amongst them, and it's quite a club. So I'm glad to be associated with that. Also, we had a breakfast with Randy and JC and Keith at our normal monthly get together, and then I guess moving into August, I don't have a whole lot scheduled for the next couple of weeks, but I'm taking a little vacation here next week, this week. So that's it.
I neglected to mention a meeting I had with Greg Carrington for the real time. Good meeting, and thank you very much.
So looking back the last couple of weeks, there's not a lot different than what others said. I did attend the retiree luncheon, a marvelous event, and I appreciate the fact that the last couple of years I've missed it, and the fact that Sheila helped coordinate to make sure that I wasn't back in Washington, D.C. during that on PUD business, so I could make it. So I do appreciate that. It is noted. And we had breakfast, as Karnan indicated. Late interlaced with all of that, and it hasn't been as much PUD associated as it has been. We're sort of on a countdown now, less than a month to go before our Chelan County delegation of nine of us goes to Kyrgyzstan for the World Nomad Games. And Rufus Woods will be going with me, as will Josh Jorgensen, the manager of Mission Ridge, and his son Will, and assistant principal at Cashmere High School, and a couple of marvelous young ladies, one of them that actually is a seasonal employee here at the PUD, Katie Tackman and Sarah Lindell. So we've been busy doing all of our organizational work, and there's a protocol in that process of gift giving. And gift giving is very big in countries in Central Asia. And I had identified a very, very cool, what I thought was cool, high-end gift for the governor, whom I knew would be at the Nomad Games. And just this last week, all of a sudden the realization dawned on me that he may not be the highest ranking official that we'll be meeting with. And sure enough, we got notification last week that the president of the country will be there. And so we have to rethink our whole gift-giving process, and that's going to take me weeks to go through. But it'll be a fun effort. But I'm hoping that our group, while it isn't directly Chelan PUD-oriented, it's Chelan County or North Central Washington-oriented. And Rufus says his intention is to provide daily news feeds back via the newspaper while we're there, so we'll see how that all goes. And really excited about it, very excited. Follow up on delegation. You wanted to do this first? I was going to do that down under other matters.
Okay, so last board meeting there were three action items, and I think all of them have been responded to. On any park status of warranty issues, Eric sent you an email on the 27th. I'll respond to that. Landscaping at parks, you asked Steve to send out an email on that, and he sent that out on the 28th, and he CC'd you all on that. And then we had Miss Van Dosen was here last board meeting, and we assigned Mike the responsibility of sending in a letter to her responding regarding the PUD, and he's going to be doing that in the short term.
Okay.
Any
questions?
This board meeting, we have five action items that Sheila recorded. And the first one is on the HDL presentation. Dennis and Gary asked for some follow-up on outreach activities associated with the HDL. And so Andy Wendell and John Stoll will be given the assignment of doing some of the follow-up as requested by both of you. Asset management model, Kirk promised to come back this fall, so you'll be seeing Kirk in the fall at some point. You asked Ann asked for some clarification on the intelligent grid customer involvement, so John Stoll has the responsibility of following up on that. There were some questions regarding the R99 renewable fuel performance, and I'm not quite sure if you wanted a report back or just an email back on the R99.
From my perspective, he answered the question.
Okay, so we can take that off.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then there was a question about how many cranes.
Yeah, would be interesting to know.
So we're going to assign Brett the responsibility of figuring out the number of cranes.
Pretty heavy engineering.
Just for my intellectual curiosity, I'm going to follow up on that question that you had regarding the alternative fuels and the ability to get emissions credits associated with converting to. So my group's been following a lot of legislative activities associated with carbon and emissions. So I'm going to do a little bit of probing on, because we have a new rule that was just published. And so you kind of sparked a interest on my part to go back and see if there's any emission credits that we could get for that. So I'm going to take a personal ownership on that and go out and see if there is any availability of.
Yeah, Greg, it seems like there should be because you're reducing your carbon footprint.
Yeah, so I'll follow up and maybe you can get emissions credits.
Well, if not, we could maybe sponsor some kind of proactive opportunity.
Did I miss any?
I don't think so.
I think so.
So is there any additional public comment? It appears to me that all left in the room are all staff. We do have, under other such matters...
Oh, I'm sorry. I looked right...
Stealth mode.
Yeah. We do have need, commissioners, to set a couple of special meetings. I think you all have a memo before you for two upcoming meetings. I guess before we set the second one, the first one is for the board workshop August 23rd. Are there three or more commissioners planning on going to the 24th Chelan substation community meeting? There's one, two. So I don't know.
So if three of you are not going to go, we don't need to set it.
Yeah, I don't
think. So the other option is we do have one more board meeting before the meeting so that we
people
could
change.
Table it and bring it back if anyone changes their mind as that date gets closer in your planning.
Yeah, Sheila, you might just note it and ask maybe at the next meeting in case.
Yeah, people might change their mind, yes. So in that case, we do need a motion to set our special meeting for our board workshop, and the wording is before you.
Mr. Chairman, I move we set a special meeting to be held at the Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Way, Wenatchee, on Tuesday, August 23rd at 9 a.m. for the purpose of a board workshop.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Is there any other business to come before us today? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.
Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you.